You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and I'd like to welcome you to the fourth annual John Hazen White Manufacturing Forum. So we are webcasting this event live, so we'd like to welcome our viewers from around the country as well as around the world. We will be archiving the video for this forum, so anybody who wishes to view this after today will have an opportunity to do so through our brookings.edu website. We also have set up a Twitter feed at hashtag USMFG. That's hashtag USMFG. So if you wish to post comments online, you're welcome to do so, raise questions. Sometimes going back and reading the virtual conversation is as interesting as listening to the conversation in the room. So we have several distinguished guests with us today. Our benefactor, John Hazen White, is here, along with his wife Liz and sons John and Ben. So we really appreciate their support in making this forum possible. So please join me in expressing our appreciation to them for their support. So for several years, we have explored different aspects of manufacturing. We've looked at the manufacturing renaissance and what is it that helped bring this sector back. We've studied the obstacles facing the industry and ways to overcome them. And then last year, we examined the Obama administration's focus on regional manufacturing hubs and what they are doing to encourage innovation and to create jobs. So with the comeback of manufacturing and its move into global exporting and advanced manufacturing, we want to focus today on workforce development and the role of community colleges in training the next generation of workers. Where are we going to find the productive workers that businesses need? There's an estimated 2 million manufacturing jobs that are going to be hard to fill over the next decade due to a skills gap. So we have to think about ways to train both the new as well as existing workers in this sector. So today we have a program that will look at several aspects of manufacturing and workforce development. Our first panel will discuss the current and future situation, and then we'll have panels that look at what people in the industry are doing to train workers, and then our last panel will focus explicitly on the role of community colleges and technical schools in workforce development. So to help us think about this topic on our first panel, we have three distinguished experts. Dr. DeRion Pollard is president of Montgomery College. In that position, she is committed to empowering students to change their lives. Montgomery is the largest undergraduate, is one of the largest undergraduate institutions in Maryland. It has around 60,000 students from 160 different countries across its three campuses. She has a lot of expertise on community colleges, both from her personal experience as well as serving on the Future of Community Colleges Commission. The Honorable David Cicilline is a member of Congress from Rhode Island. He was elected to Congress in 2010. There he works on issues related to manufacturing as well as other issues. He has introduced the Make It in America legislation in order to help retrain American workers and other bills to create a national manufacturing strategy. And prior to his legislative service, he was the mayor of Providence for 8 years. Dr. Celeste Carter is the lead program director on the Advanced Technological Education Program at the National Science Foundation. And in that position, she works to encourage a highly qualified entry-level technical workforce. Her program has 21 years of experience in supporting community and technical colleges and other institutions that partner with industry to educate the workforce. So I want to start with Dr. Pollard. I mean, you are on the front lines of educating the next generation. And in a recent magazine article, you said that, quote, community college is the place where the American dream becomes real. It's a very provocative statement. So first of all, what did you mean by that? And then what is Montgomery College doing to train students for careers in manufacturing as well as other areas?
Well, thank you for the invitation. I'm delighted to be here, and I trust my colleagues to the left and right of me to hit me if I get on my bandwagon, because I happen to think that community colleges are potentially the most transformative institution in contemporary America. We do the work that America needs to have done, and we do it with populations that are oftentimes underserved, underrecognized, and undervalued. I say that very specifically because we serve the working reservist and the returning veteran, the native son and the immigrant daughter, the person who is coming to us to retrain while at the same time the one who's looking to figure out how to make their lives and themselves better, the single dad and the working mother, all of them find themselves at institutions such as community colleges where we are in fact doing the heavy lifting of higher education. About almost half of undergraduates in this country attend a community college. And the reality about that, as our communities and as our country becomes browner, older, and less wealthy in many areas, community colleges are the driving force as an anchor institution in connecting so many needs of the community with the resources that can help propel and drive not only workforce development but economic development in a community. Montgomery College, as you describe, is an extremely large community college. We serve 60,000 students, three campuses, two educational centers, and dozens of local area sites that we're working. I think our distinctive competency, though, in this space is that we have figured out how to reclaim this work that we're doing in terms of workforce development to drive economic development for our community. We were having a previous discussion before we walked in here, and I said manufacturing in a lot of ways actually needs a branding campaign. We need to figure out how to look at the language. And I'm an English teacher by training, so a part of me thinks about this idea of how we name things, how we look at the vernacular, the lexicon. How do we talk about manufacturing and look at this in a way that has relevancy to an 18-year-old and a 48-year-old who have very different constructs about what manufacturing is, yet and still we have industries that are clamoring for folks to come in and do this type of work. So Montgomery College has done this, I think, in several different ways. One is that we've actually tried to develop several frameworks to help people understand the work that we do. We've defined our workforce development work into five specific areas, but we've tightly coupled that with the emerging industries in our community. So, for instance, we have developed over 130 programs of study, from short-term certificates to associate's degrees, but we're also looking at in Montgomery County itself, where we have communities that are high wealth and we also have high poverty. All 26 Montgomery County high schools have students at Montgomery College. Every zip code has a student at Montgomery College. That's not the narrative. So how do we bring the counter-narrative to the forefront? Part of that is looking at how we partner with the emerging biotechnology community in Montgomery County to look at the entry pathways into technology positions. The reality is that the person who's going to find the next cure for cancer and manufacture that particular type of work is going to have to do that with a very different skill set, but they're also going to need a whole series of people who help them do that work. So there's a very thoughtful process about entryway pathways, helping to build capacity. We're also spending a lot of time with industries who come into us and saying, I have a very talented workforce at my place, but they are retiring. We're needing to upskill. Our industry is changing dramatically. How do you provide training and education for them in ways that can be very thoughtful and relevant? So we're doing that work. And I think the other thing that we're doing is actually inserting ourselves into county and state conversations about economic development and workforce development. It's very comfortable for lots of folks to think about how can we do this work without changing anything. The reality about that, if we want to speak to this national conversation, this global dialogue, a part of what we have to do as institutions is redesign ourselves. I give a plug to Tom's phenomenal book. I have a book club going on at the college right now about how we're doing this type of work at our institution, but challenging the narrative about how we do this work and then tightly coupling with businesses to say, you have this need. The last one I'll speak to and how we're doing this very specifically is also looking at the pathway. And this is something that troubles me a lot. When we have conversations about what's happening in our community, what's happening in our world, we're speaking a lot to the haves. We're not speaking to the have-nots. We have to have very thoughtful conversations about who is not a part of the conversation, who is not excelling in the spaces we need them to excel at. We don't have the luxury right now of waiting for everybody to get to that point. We have to figure out how do we create these pathways from the K-12 space into the community college space. Those folks who are coming out of the prison system, how are we working with them? Because as our former governor here in Maryland said, we need everybody to work. And we need everybody to come out and contribute to the bottom line. So how do we make sure that we are looking at the access points for the pathways into this work, but also as institutions, how we redesign ourselves to do that work, and then finally, how we more tightly couple ourselves with industry to make sure we're meeting the goals that they need.
Thank you. You're exactly right. This is a sector that is changing dramatically, yeah. So it does create new challenges for a range of different institutions. So, Congressman Cicilline, you've spent a lot of time working on manufacturing and workforce development in Congress. So what is the federal government doing to support the training of manufacturing workers, and what should it be doing? Are there things it's not doing that you would recommend we do?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you again, and thank you to the White family for their wonderful sponsorship of this event. Well, I think, first of all, most importantly, continue the policies that are helping to create this manufacturing renaissance. That's a whole range of policies having to do with changes in our tax code, having to do with research and development tax credits, and all the things ending the offshoring tax credits so that we're not incentivizing companies to move jobs overseas. So I think making sure we continue to maintain a strong demand for American-made goods, modernizing the Buy America programs, a whole range of things that will continue to make sure that there's a great worldwide demand for American-made goods, because otherwise you're training workers for jobs that don't exist.
Sure.
But you're right that there is a huge need for trained workers, qualified workers for this new or more advanced manufacturing. There's a real shift to more highly skilled manufacturing. It used to be, you know, if your mom or dad worked at a manufacturing facility, you could graduate from high school, basically go back to the same big factory where they worked and get a job and make a good living and support your family. That's not the case today in most places. The requirements are for greater skills, in part because of automation and kind of those big factory, big assembly line kinds of operations don't exist as much. And so one of the things that we've done, there are a number of initiatives, the investing in manufacturing community partnerships, the RAMI, those things which Brookings really focused on last year, are helping communities develop coordinated strategies around manufacturing to be sure that we can kind of grow the manufacturing sectors in places all around this country. I really want to just reaffirm we have to continue that. But I think community colleges are really the answer for how do we train this next generation of young people and retrain existing manufacturing workers to meet the demands in the workforce today. And I agree with the president. Part of this is also changing the narrative about manufacturing. You know, people used to think manufacturing is dirty, it's a dead end, the factories are closing, it didn't seem like a bright future. There's been a real change in the attitude about making things in this country, particularly with the maker movement and young people thinking about what manufacturing means. And so I really do think we've got, you know, when some kid comes home and says, I want to go into manufacturing, mom and dad, most parents would say, really? You know, and I think we've got to really change that. And that means in high schools and Korean technical academies, having manufacturing tracks so that people are starting to develop the skills that they need and young people are exposed to that. We need to continue to fund in a very robust way. Programs like the Department of Labor and Training has a program in Rhode Island with the Community College of Rhode Island the actual name of it is Pathways in Advanced Manufacturing, Accelerate Pathways in Advanced Manufacturing. It's using the community college to train young people for careers in advanced manufacturing. It has two components. One is a boot camp so that young people can really get exposed to a variety of different things and see what they're good at and what they like. And it's this match of earn and learn model where they're actually earning money, which is a reality for lots of young people at that stage in their lives while they're learning and exploring a career path. So investing in our community colleges and creating this pathway and being certain that in these development of the curriculum and the program that you're working closely with the workforce development boards, the governor's workforce advisory groups, the institutions of higher education. We did pass last year a workforce reform bill, and I think making sure that we are also funding programs like Job Corps and Youth Build and all those early programs that provide people with an early opportunity to try some of the skills that are available in manufacturing. The reason this is all really important is because every manufacturing facility I've ever visited says, I have jobs available.
Yeah.
I can't find people to fill the position with the skills necessary. And, you know, that's even in places like Rhode Island that has a very high unemployment rate. So the jobs are out there, that we've got to make sure that the workforce has the skills necessary, and making sure we're listening to and carefully integrating the employers in all of these conversations. Because I think for many years, you know, job training programs were created and produced people for what we imagined existed in terms of the demand in the marketplace. And it was sort of stunning to me, the lack of conversation between the employers and the workforce development board saying, what do you actually need? So I think community colleges are absolutely in the place and the institution that can help to transform not only our economy, but not only for manufacturing, but in a much larger way in our economy.
And I think that last point is really crucial. Even in 2009, when we had a 10% national unemployment rate, there were certain sectors that could not fill available jobs, certainly high-tech sectors, advanced manufacturing, and so on. So, Dr. Carter, you work on the Advanced Technological Education Program at the National Science Foundation. So what is this program doing to contribute to manufacturing and technical education?
Well, I'd like to start by saying thank you to Congress, because the reason the ATE exists at the National Science Foundation is because in 1992, the passage of the SETA Act mandated NSF to develop this program that puts community and technical colleges in leadership roles for educating highly qualified entry-level technical people for all of the advanced technology fields. The program has about $66 million a year. We make anywhere from 50 to 75 awards a year, going to not just community and technical colleges, although they have leadership roles on all projects, also to grades 7 through 12. So the idea of pathways was very important, and four-year institutions. Every single award that's made has to have significant industry collaborators or partners. And an additional point is to work with your regional workforce investment board, or WIB, or your economic development agency. So this is truly a program that's now been around for 21 years, supporting a highly qualified technical workforce. And about, I would say, close to somewhere between 30 and 40% of the awards we make each year are related to advanced manufacturing. If not very specifically, we are developing at Community College X a new mechatronics program in collaboration with our industry partner. There's a lot of the supporting roles that are played. Nanotechnology is one of the ones that is certainly active and participating in advanced manufacturing. We have biomanufacturing, biotechnology. Optics and photonics isn't maybe one you would naturally think of, but there's laser-enabled manufacturing, and we have centers and projects funded in that. Rapid prototyping, or 3D printing. So this is a program that really pushes the community to think about how to effectively partner with your industry and your economic development people to build a program, or it could be a certificate, it could be an associate's degree, some sort of a pathway, and then also provide faculty professional development and teacher development so that the people who are in those classrooms actually understand what they are doing and why they are doing it, how relevant it is to the jobs that are available to students that are going to be graduating from these programs. So this is one of those programs that truly is responsive to the exact topic that we're talking about today. And really, we've covered every state in the United States, the territories as well. We're working on one new area of it's been around now since 2009, trying to bring more of the community and technical colleges into the program. There are approximately almost 1,200 community colleges. And we've reached, I would say, between a third pushing towards a half. We have an area in this program called small grants for institutions new to the ATE program. So it has to be a community college that has either never come in to this program before or hasn't come in 10 years. And that grows the diversity of the program greatly. I'd also like to mention that, you know, community colleges are the entryways, right, for a huge number of students. Whoever walks through the door of your classroom is who you're going to serve. And so you have it's a tremendous opportunity to reach a lot of the underrepresented populations in the science, technology, and engineering math occupations. Approximately, I think, more than 50% of the Latino or Hispanic students are at community colleges. It's very close to that for African Americans. It's a great way to broaden participation and to reach some of the populations that we need to reach. So that's the ATE program. And another program that I talk about a lot with community and technical colleges is another congressionally mandated program. It's called the S-STEM Scholarship Program. And it's one that Congress looked at H-1B visa money and said, gee, here's all of these industries and corporations that say they can't find a qualified person in the United States. Why don't we take some of those funds that they are paying for visas and use it to develop a program to support growing the population of people in the United States who would be highly qualified. So it's academically talented, financially needy students. And when I talk to a large population of community college, either faculty or presidents, I say, how many of you have that type of student on your campus? And every hand goes up in the room, right? So that's another program that is really supporting this work. A lot of people that come into ATE will say, how can I support some of these students? I'll say, leverage this. Use what you're developing with the ATE money, but go look for one of these scholarship awards as well so that you can support these students and bring them in. So I think that kind of gives you a basis of what ATE is about and some of the things that the National Science Foundation is doing.
Sounds like you have lots of new initiatives going on. So I'd like to throw out a question to each of you on the panel. And I know you're kind of coming from different perspectives. And then after this, we'll open up the floor to any questions and comments from you. So the question is, what are the biggest barriers that you see in terms of workforce development, and how can we overcome them? And this can be in terms of government policy, college curricula, how to deal with underserved populations. Congressman Cicilline, you mentioned the Maker movement. Like, are there civic organizations that should be doing new or different things? Dr. Pollard, I'll start with you. Barriers and ways to overcome them.
So I think there are probably, in my mind, three or four broad barriers, and I won't speak to all of them because I think the other panelists are probably more qualified to speak to them, particularly in terms of some of the policy issues and legislation that could help provide this. I think, as I said earlier, I'm an English teacher, so I spend a lot of time thinking about words. And one of the things that strikes me is that we have to have a substantive conversation about what it means to go to college, right? I am always struck when I have an 8-year-old son, and he knows he'll be second generation college student from my family. And what I find very provocative about that is that he says to me, Mama, but what is college? So we have to talk about what college is and what that means. But this idea that you go to college to earn an esoteric degree that has no relevancy or currency in the workforce, I think is an old trope that we have to figure out a different way of thinking about it. The reality is that you come to college to learn a skill set that will help you get a job. And oftentimes, you have to get a job to pay for the tofu. I had a friend who told me that not too long ago. The reality about it is that you also have to have a job that's going to help you be sustainable. And those jobs are going to require you to go to a place that has relevancy, that has currency, and that has connections to the workforce and the community that you live in. So we have to really start talking about the fact that you don't have to go to college. What you have to do is you have to go and get an education that will allow you to be successful. And the way that you can do that is through college. It doesn't mean you have to go away to some of the best prestigious institutions in our country. You can do that. You can also come to your prestigious community college locally and get a curriculum that's going to allow you to get a job that will allow you to go debt-free and allow you to be able to make a relevant change for you and your family. So I think we have to have a substantive conversation about what education means, what going to college means, what workforce development means. It's quite du jour right now. Everybody is in vogue to talk about workforce development and is talking, oh, wow, community colleges, we've been doing this for 100 years. I mean, it kind of baffles me that, you know, over 100 years, community colleges have been doing workforce development. For over 100 years, we've been helping drive economic development. And all of a sudden, somebody finally said, wow, yeah. Community college, we've been doing apprenticeships. You know, we've been doing this work and operating in this space, but the problem is that the cultural narrative, the cultural conversation hasn't kept in track with what we've been doing. I'll also say the community colleges have not done a very good job of talking about what we do. And we also have to bring more to the table in terms of describing the evidence to say that we're doing that particular type of work. So that's one broad area. The other area is that we have to have a substantive conversation in this country about the inequity that exists in terms of the socioeconomic gaps here in our country. And how do we begin to build pipelines to ensure that every child, every adult, has the understanding that there is a space and place, there is a need. I heard Secretary Perez say, there are no surplus Americans. So I would offer to you, there should not be any surplus Americans who can't find work and relevant ways to support them and their family, but also there should not be surplus industries, right? So we need to recognize that every industry, if they're a part of the economic driver of this country, needs to have people who can go into that and be qualified and talented to help drive that work. So I think there's a combination of issues there, but I think we have to have some authenticity in our conversations. You know, I mentioned earlier, I'm from the south side of Chicago, and we believe in a couple of things. One is that you work hard, but you got to play hard. And part of that is speaking truth. And part of that is making people a little uncomfortable. And part of that is also recognizing you got to do some things a little bit differently if you want different results. You can't keep doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different result. So those are just some of my thoughts.
Great point. Congressman Cicilline, what are the biggest barriers you see and how could we overcome them?
I think Dr. Wall is absolutely right, particularly about this idea of rethinking and reengaging in a conversation of what kind of college is. You know, I think for a long time in this country, I mean, I remember when I was mayor, we'd go into classrooms of second and third graders and the principal would say, who's going to college? Is everyone going to college? Raise your hand. I'd say, stop doing that. You know, everyone is not going to college, and stop suggesting to these kids that if they don't go to college, somehow they're not successful or they can't have a productive and meaningful life. And I do think that we have got to, you know, begin to have a conversation in this country about what the purpose of post-secondary education is. You know, for a long time, you didn't even talk about a job. It was like you went to be educated.
Right.
And it's like you were, oh, my God, you know, right. It's like, no, actually, you want to be able to support and sustain yourself and eat and house yourself. So this idea of connecting it to some real-world requirements and preparation for the workforce, I mean, we've got to really have that conversation. And I think what I see as the biggest barrier, or the biggest obstacle, is access to education, whether it's to the community college, whether it's to a workforce training program, whether it's a spot at the Job Corps. We just don't have enough access, which is why I think the president's proposal for a free community college is so exciting, because it will really change, you know, it will sort of move what we now expect as K-12 education as a public function that everyone has access to for free and make it K-14, which I think is consistent with the demands of the world in which we live. And so ensuring that everyone has the opportunity to access free community college, who then can make decisions about whether it's manufacturing or another career path, I think will do more than just about anything else we can do. So I think it's access to the education and training that is necessary for the jobs that we're speaking about that is the single biggest obstacle.
So, Dr. Carter, your views on the barriers and the remedies, and then we'll get questions from the audience.
All right. So I'd like to step back to that, the public perception, because I think that is really a tremendous barrier still in a lot of these programs. The ATE program has been supporting the development of these types of programs now for 21 years. They exist at multiple community colleges across the United States, and I will say that one of the things that happens, and this is typical of every community college, when there's an economic downturn, the enrollment at a community college goes up. Mm-hmm. As the economy returns, the enrollment starts going down. So that's pretty typical. That you can see that cycling across the country. But one of the things that we've seen happen with a lot of these programs is without an understanding of what the career pathways are about, the students, even if they know about the program, don't enroll. We have one center in Albuquerque that's called the MEMS Center, or Micro Electrical Mechanical Systems. So people say, well, what is that? What do they do? Well, you could say, well, things, you know, there are things like putting DNA on a chip to understand and diagnose diseases. There's a huge role for that. This program has been around. for quite some time. For years, they were lucky if they had 6 students enrolling in the program. They had industry waiting at the door to take the people and hire them and get them into these positions. So a lot of that is perception. So I still think that idea that it would be great to have some big PR firm step up and say, let's re-envision and let's make a change. I know the state of North Carolina did that with biotechnology. One of the community colleges, Alamance Community College, had a program that had been kind of limping along with not very many students every year. North Carolina started putting up billboards saying biotechnology is our next economic driver. And since that time, that program is over-enrolled. People got the idea. They started looking up and figuring out what does it mean to have a career in biotechnology. I think it's something we really need to think about broadly across all of these advanced technologies, from manufacturing to high-tech welding, to all of these various things that are going on in the United States.
Okay, so our panelists have put a number of ideas on the table. We'd like to open the floor to any questions and comments from here. Right here we have 2 questions, so we'll take each of you. We have a microphone that's coming over to you. If you can give us your name and your organization.
Hi, thanks very much. My name is Mindy Reiser. I'm a sociologist, and I'm on the board of governors of an organization called LERA, the Labor and Employment Relations Association, which has had many discussions on these topics. I'd like you to think about and address, if you could, 2 points. One, how the role of MOOCs is transforming what education means, where it's delivered, and how industry itself can liaise with community colleges in delivering that. And also senior citizens in this country who often are not in economically great shape and need work and need new training. How are you beginning to address that population? Often you're focusing on young people at the beginning of their work lives, but we need to think about the other end of the work trajectory and how to reach those people. So your thoughts would be welcome.
If you don't mind, I'll start with the last question first, because I think one of the things that's very distinctive about community colleges is that, you know, I like to think that we are engaged with a human's potential from cradle to grave. So the reality is the average age of my student is 28 at Montgomery College. This year we had graduates who graduated who were 72 years old from Montgomery College, and it was a beautiful thing to watch them walk across the stage, but also see them pointing to their child who was also earning a degree and their grandchild who was there who's also a student at Montgomery College as well, and to talk about what that meant for their family, changing the trajectory of a family at that particular point. In fact, one of our speakers was a coal miner from West Virginia who heard about our HVAC program at Montgomery College, moved to Montgomery College, had an apprenticeship with one of our local companies, and is working through and was one of our distinguished speakers at our commencement program. I had a lot of national press because he talked about this idea that people thought that I was down and out, and here I am doing something very different and changing the narrative for his entire family. So I think your comment is very powerful. I'd like to think we already do that work in community colleges. In fact, the American Association of Community Colleges has a whole initiative on 50 plus where they have provided grants to a number of colleges across the country to help target very specifically this population of seniors who are transitioning out of formal work or those who are having to extend their work life because of circumstances of their lives and other things. So I think we do that very well. If that's a distinctive competency of community colleges, I think that would be one that would be recognized. The other thing about MOOCs, I though think, is an interesting conversation. I think that it certainly is providing this access question that we talked about. What I'm seeing, though, at our institution, and we're actually seeing this in higher education, there's a great piece, I think, in the Chronicle a couple weeks ago that actually talked about this idea that MOOCs are a way of providing an entree point for many people, but the reality about that is that for a lot of our students who come to community colleges, what they need is support services as well, and then how do we put that particular MOOC and couple it with support services, but also other classroom experiences that helps a student really connect all of those things together, and how do employers start to look at this type of work? So this whole question of credentialing and more badges and other types of things, I think there's a broader conversation that's out there about that. I have not seen the MOOCs have that type of impact yet in the workforce. I haven't heard that from my local employers who I spend a lot of time with, but I'll certainly pose that question to them.
And the other thing on MOOCs is they attract a lot of students, but the completion rate is 5 to 10%.
Right. And I would say rather than looking at a MOOC, one of the things that has come about in the ATE program is people developing hybrid courses.
Yeah.
So for greater access for everyone, whatever you want to consider it, a lecture part, whether you're doing a flipped classroom, whatever your pedagogical strategy is, you engage students broadly, but then there's some central site where once or twice a month, everyone shows up on a weekend and they actually get the hands-on skills and competencies. And part of that, especially around advanced manufacturing, it's the skills and competencies that really make a difference between a person who's finished a four-year degree where they have not had a lot of those experiences and a student who's had both the sort of academic rigor of the coursework along with gaining those skills and competencies. It makes them a better candidate for the job.
We have a gentleman right here who has a question.
I'm Randall Doyle. I'm Georgetown University. I taught at the university level for many years, and then I taught at the community college level, and I was stunned to find out that 80, 90% of the faculty is adjunct and underpaid. And I hear what you're saying, and the programs sound great, okay? But what I discovered from working at a community college level was tremendous resentment that when 80, 90% of the faculty are working for crappy wages, no health care, and then they're expected to carry out these wonderful agendas and so forth, to me it doesn't make any sense. I think one of the weaknesses, I agree with President Obama's community thing, free community college, it's all great and stuff, but what about the other half of hiring a faculty, paying them a living wage, giving them health care and so forth, and making the place more professional for the faculty to be there? Because I can tell you, having been there myself and everything, that there is tremendous resentment and anger and so forth when basically a handful of people are making a living wage and everybody else is working for crap wages. So, you know, I think to implement these programs that have a higher success rate in some of these programs and so forth, I think that if you flip that and had 80, 90% of the faculty actually making a wage, showing up to work and so forth, instead of looking over their shoulder trying to figure out how to pay their bills, I think you'd have a greater commitment by these people toward these programs, toward these schools. Now, I don't know how the president's going to get around that and so forth. You can offer free education, but for God's sake, I mean, if you want quality people to implement these programs, you got to pay them. You got to pay them a living wage.
Remember, the president's proposal is not that the students show up and it's free. It's that it's being paid for by the federal government and the state. So presumably, it will have no net effect on the cost to the community college because they'll receive the same tuition and fees. It just won't come from the individual, it'll come from the government. I think your point is a broader one, that we have to put community college leadership and community college teaching in the same category that we do with four-year colleges and universities, and to the extent that we can ensure people have good pay and permanent positions. I think, again, that requires an additional investment in community colleges, which I'm a strong supporter of, and I think good community colleges do that already. Not every community college does it, but...
Well, and let's be real. We can't afford it. So if you want, I'll put it out here, and this is a very... And I had this conversation. I'm the only community college in the state of Maryland where I have my adjunct faculty who bargain collectively, and we sit across the table and have some real hard conversations. And here's the hard conversation about it. We're not funded to do that. And the design of how community colleges started 100 years ago and probably most recently in the 60s and 70s, it was designed... Adjunct faculty had a very distinctive purpose. It was to provide flexibility for the schedule, to allow us to make sure that we can offer courses throughout the day at times and places to meet the community's needs, and secondly, to provide relevancy for the curriculum. So I'm able to bring in a master HVAC person to come in and work, who can work alongside our full-time faculty to provide a compilation of skills and experiences for a student. That's what it was designed to do. But what happened, now if you want to get real, let me put my pad down here.
Now we're getting serious.
The serious fact is that we have continue to see an underinvestment, in some cases a disinvestment, if you look across the nation, in higher education. Mm-hmm. So as a result of that, we had to do, folks keep saying, community colleges, open your doors, send me your tired, we're sending our tired, our huddle, our folks who need more resources to you, who demand and need more from you, we're going to send them to you, but guess what? In the state of Maryland, I'm going to give you, for every dollar I give to USM, I'm giving you 18 cents from the state of Maryland. So let's keep it real, right? So at the end of the day, what you have created is, in some cases, a perceived caste system where you have full-time faculty and part-time faculty, but the design was never intended for that. So now, as a result, colleges say, how do I get wise about this? I've got these thousands of students who are coming to us because the economy is getting bad, so I'm going to hire more adjunct faculty because it allows us to be flexible, it allows them to be able to do these types of things. The reality is we want to have a substantive conversation about labor policy in community colleges. It's a much bigger one than simply saying to us, how do you begin to just put more, because we don't have the money. You
okay,
simply don't have the resources.
That's a fundamental shift in how...
Fundamental.
Okay, there's a woman right here in the aisle who has a question. Yep. Can you give us your name and organization?
I'm Monica Herc from the Committee for Economic Development, and my question doesn't quite reach the same level of passion, but...
I'll take some water now.
Yeah.
But some of the answers may. You never know.
Yes, so. we'll see. So Dr. Carter was talking about the MEM degree and how employers were lining up for it and putting up billboards about that. I'm wondering if there's a role for more counseling when students come into community colleges to say to them, you know, given your aptitudes and interests, you know, there's employers in this community who are hiring for this job. You could finish this degree, and this is what you're likely to make when you walk out the door.
I would love to see that happen. And typically what happens, I used to go down, I had a biotechnology program in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I was a faculty member at Foothill College. And I had the same problem getting students through the door each year. I would go in, my dean every spring would say, well, you know, your program is redlined. You ought to have people, you know, coming out the door. And there's over 1,200 biotech companies in the area. Why aren't you over-enrolled? But there was no public relations or advertising about the program. Everything falls on the faculty member to do. And I would go to the counselors every year with a binder. I would say, here's the companies that have hired. This is their entry level, you know, this is their entry level pay. I would find out later that what they would tell students is, oh, you know, this is science. It's really hard. You should go into the liberal arts. You don't really have the aptitude to do this. And that wasn't true at all. It really wasn't true. One of the things I finally wised up to, actually had a student push me to do this, was she said, I'm taking a marketing and PR class here. Why don't you go talk to the faculty member who's teaching it? Every single student in the class has to develop a marketing PR plan for some entity. So I ended up with two students who got me free radio spots on the Stanford radio station, free spots on the San Jose public television station, targeted mailings to high schools and other, you know, other entities around the area, and posters even for on the campus, because students there didn't even know there was a biotech program, even though it had been around for 13 years. I tell that story on myself, and I say I was the one who didn't think of doing that. It was a student who pushed me to do that. So counselors are just one aspect of it. There's a whole realm of other things that need to happen to keep getting students aware of and coming into these programs.
Can I just add one thing? And that counseling demand actually exists at the high school level, too. I mean, the conversation should actually be happening as people are concluding their high school education so they can have conversations about community college or about career pathways. There's been, unfortunately, a real reduction in the availability of counselors at the high school level, too, and
right.
I think that's
right.
Exacerbating the problem.
There's a question of a woman on the aisle right back there. Yep.
Hi, Hannah Hodell, U.S. Department of Education. Thank you for coming to speak here today. You talked about the importance of changing the narrative of manufacturing so that it's multi-generational and targeting underserved and undervalued populations. At present, women make up less than a third of the manufacturing population. How do we get more women interested in staying in manufacturing jobs?
So I can speak to that a little bit. We actually have a couple of very, very active projects that are deliberately going out and coming up with recruitment materials specifically to attract women into these jobs. One of them is based in California. The principal investigator is Donna Milgram, and she literally works on bringing women into all of these career spaces very, very successfully. She's now partnering across the entire community college, ATE community, bringing in the techniques and the sort of how do you model things appropriately. So that's one thing that happens. I do also remember talking to a dean in engineering, and he said, you know, we did a summer boot camp for women, And man, every single one who went through that boot camp showed up in the first semester class for engineering. And by the end of the first semester, not a single one was left. And he went into the classroom and watched them, and he said, look, you know, I'm from the military, I've got a military background. He said, one of the things we do in the military is we videotape people as they teach so that we can go back and say, now you may not have perceived that you were giving this message to some of the people in your audience, but you were. He said, I'm going to try that. I'm going to see if that turns things around, because it was the instructors that were providing the wrong message once these people, once the women got into the classroom. Unfortunately, he hasn't come back, so I don't know how successful it was. I'd love to know.
I would offer a couple of the things to add to that. One is that we have to start earlier having these conversations. I love the conversation that was earlier that the representative talked about, saying let's take this to the high school level. I last week was talking to a group of fifth graders, and the reality is we have to start talking earlier and earlier about what it means to be educated, what's the public good versus the private good, but also to talk about this idea that everyone needs to see themselves represented in the workforce in that way. And I think for us who do the hiring within our institutions, we have a strong commitment. And I look at an engineering program. We have the largest community college transfer engineering program in the country. We send students from directly into industry, but also we had students graduate and go from Montgomery College to MIT last year. The reality about that is that we have hired faculty who look like the students that we serve and who are able to talk about how you navigate an experience that may not be something where people are giving you the messages that you can be successful. And then I think the other thing that we're doing is how do we also then with our students create support services, learning communities, other things to help them be able to say, let's be very thoughtful and intentional about your experience. You're going to have a panelist later who's probably going to talk about this. These pathways and intentionality and how we systematically redesign our organizations to get these outputs. We don't have the opportunity just to wait for it to happen. I call it intrusive, deliberate, and making sure that we systematically look at all of the inputs to get the outputs that we need to have.
There's a question over here. Did you have a question? Yeah, right here on the aisle.
Thank you. Ariane Higovich, Institute for Women's Policy Research. I also had the women's question, but you kind of answered. My other question is, manufacturing in our space is very much targeted as good middle-skill jobs where you do not need a full degree. But then from your discussion, a lot of the emphasis is on advanced manufacturing. It's not your father's manufacturing job. You can't just walk in with a high school degree. So how much is it still a kind of an occupation which allows people who do not get a four-year college, maybe don't even get a two-year college, to get in and get a decent job? And how does that also, this overall emphasis on getting more skilled workers, how does it align with the Workforce Innovation Opportunities Act, the emphasis on really low-skilled, disadvantaged workers?
So if you don't mind, and I'm happy to be quiet on this issue, I'll give you an example of what we've done with this right now, cybersecurity. We were very lucky to receive for the state of Maryland, and we're hosting it, a grant, one of the tech grants, where we're looking at this whole issue of cybersecurity. And what I think is very interesting about this is that for a lot of folks, when we talk about this, your question struck me. Do you need college? I think we have to get out of our head this idea that college is a four-year baccalaureate degree. That is no longer a definition that's viable. College, I love how post-secondary higher education has many outlets. You can get short-term certificates, long-term certificates, associate degrees, baccalaureate degrees. And to be quite frank, in our biotechnology program, 60% of the students who are coming to get a certificate in biotechnology from Montgomery College already have a baccalaureate degree. 40% of them already have a master's degree with unqualified skills to allow them to step into a workforce. So I think we have to, again, it's not only the narrative, it's the lexicon, it's the vernacular that we use around what it means to go to college. But what we've done with this TAC grant in cybersecurity is to create on-ramps so that people can come in and get short-term certificates and degrees, short-term certificates, go into the work, come out, come back in, and then begin to create stackable credentials to allow them to move into workforce. That, to me, has to be the way we have to think about this. A high school diploma is very powerful. That should be the minimal expectation that we have for education. The reality is that anyone who's going to be able to have a sustainable living wage, Montgomery County, for a family of four to live without any financial support is $80,000 a year. You will not find a job with a high school diploma doing that in Montgomery County. So we have to have a substantive conversation about how we create credentials to get you to that level.
I like that concept of stackable credentials.
Right. Yeah, and it's not new.
In the very back, there's a woman with her hand up. There's a microphone coming over to you.
Good morning. My name is Cynthia Robbins, and I'm an independent consultant working on various issues of access to justice and opportunity. And one of the two questions that I had, and some they've been somewhat addressed. One is the issue of online universities and education and how you blend that into what you're doing. And I want to back up. I used to run a program here in D.C. called Maya Angelou Public Charter School in Sea Forever. And one of the things, it was an alternative school, and we sent our young people off to college many years at a rate exceeding 80 or 90%, and these were children who had been pushed out of public schools. So it's clear that when you set high expectations, you can have extraordinary outcomes. So the question I have is around stigma. I think that a lot of people think of community college and they think, you know, you didn't really do it.
Yeah.
You didn't get where you needed to be. And there's all this focus on trying to get into four-year colleges. So I just ask something about, and I love the stories that you shared about your public relations efforts. And I think that on the issue of stigma, that would be a real place that across the nation, there could be some real new thinking about community colleges. I love the name of them, right? So there should be an appeal. But right now, I think for too many, it's seen as the fallback failure spot and not the catapult and catalyst for you going on to broad, extraordinary educational experiences. Mm. So a little bit about how you might change stigma into, you know, stepping stone and wonderful, you know, staircase to glory kind of thing.
So maybe I could start on that because that is something that comes up a lot. But to go back to it's Collins who has your biotech program.
Yeah.
And I had a biotech program, and I would say over 15 years, I probably had less than 10 students that were entering with a high school degree only. So I had people with PhDs, with masters, with bachelor's degrees. Another biomanufacturing program at Solano Community College in California, 80 to 90% of their entering class each year has a recent degree from the University of California, a baccalaureate degree. They can't get a job.
Yep.
Industry tells them you don't have the competencies and skills that you need. So one of the things we started doing was referring to ourselves as the reverse articulation pathway. So, and I'd have students come in and they'd say, well, you know, every single thing in your program doesn't transfer for credit. So I'm not going to take everything in your biotech program. I'm not going to finish your certificate. I'd say, that's fine. You transfer. I'll see you when you finish your four-year degree because you'll be back. And one of the things that people have been doing is building these truly a pathway with multiple on-ramps and off-ramps. And that's one of the things that is truly being successful. And I think as far as the high school piece of it, it's looking at dual credit. There's more and more people thinking about how to be creative about that. How do you actually get a pathway? So one of the things that happens in a lot of these disciplines as well is students are bored with a lot of the entry classes. You know, it's like in biology, it's like, come on, you expect me to memorize all 1,200 pages of Campbell's textbook? And, you know, how boring can that be? So one of the things that people are doing is sort of shaking up the system, thinking about how to create pathways that allow students to see you could do a certificate. Matter of fact, I used to get people hired out of my program, which my administrators didn't like very much because they said we can't get that completion number. But industry would say, as soon as you get this base level of competencies, I'm taking you. And I hired as adjuncts a lot of people from industry to come and teach technical courses at night. and they would literally cherry pick out of my program. And I always figured that since the students came to get a job, that was a good thing to do. But it's letting students know all of those options and building those options into it. One very successful program is a learning community that was initially developed at the City College of San Francisco and has now been adapted and adopted in a lot of other communities, community colleges across the United States, that partners three courses. It just links three courses up in one semester of an understanding of biotechnology, the math you need to be successful, and the writing and English skills you need to be successful. And that learning community alone has transformed entry into a lot of these programs. So other people are adapting and adopting that model as well. And so I think that however you refer to it, I visited Australia and looked at their technical institutes. They have a one-page flyer that says in every single occupation, if you finish this certificate, this is the jobs you can look for, and here's your salary. If you later come back and you get the next certificate or certification, these are the jobs you can apply for, this is your salary. And it builds all the way up into mid-level administration within a lot of the industries. And I think that would be a great thing to develop here.
Okay, I think we have time just for one more question, then we're going to move to our next panel, and right here on the aisle. Yeah, there's a microphone coming over to you. This is the last question, so it has to be a really good question.
No pressure.
Hello. I'm Hayden Springer. I'm with the Center for Regional Economic Competitiveness, and this is a bit of a different question. You mentioned a number of important things to you, delivering programs that give people the skills that are in demand, identifying career pathways, helping teachers understand why what they're doing is important, and giving schools the funding that they need. So we work a lot with workforce and economic development professionals as well as TAC grant folks to know how to access and interpret data. And we find that skills data is majorly lacking, that it's very difficult to identify good career pathways without that data, and that BLS funding is declining and it's trickling down to the states as well as the community colleges. So what I'd like you to address is, how are you dealing with these issues of lack of data in developing your programs?
Actually, that's a great closing question. Yeah. Panelists?
I would say, you've worked with the TACT grantees. So one of the things that every single awardee under that program from the Department of Labor had to do was figure out a way to try and get those metrics. Sometimes you can look at unemployment data. Sometimes, as you say, BLS data helps. One of the things that the ATE program is helping to support is a study at the National Academies that's ongoing right now on middle skills jobs. We just had a convocation on that a week or so ago, and there was a lot of discussion about what data sets can be accessed and what they show. It's a tough problem. It is a tough problem. I think the ATE program, in a way, gets around that program by or problem by developing those really close ties with industry, so that the community and technical college, working in partnership with industry, be it one company or multiple companies in a region, really understands what's going on there and can build the kind of program that provides the needed skills and educational background that people need. Is that an answer nationally? I don't know. One of the things I'm trying to do is to get regional centers to work together on a national level by developing called coordination networks within this program. And we'll see if maybe that helps the issue. Another one is to look at things like what the Manufacturing Institute is doing in pulling together all of the industry-validated certifications and then looking at how they can be interwoven into academic programs. This is one thing that Jennifer McNally, the president of the Manufacturing Institute, has worked with the Florida Manufacturing Center that's supported by ATE. And every every manufacturing and engineering technology program in the state of Florida has interwoven into every program industry-validated certification so that a student knows when they come in they'll be prepared to take an exam. If they have that certification, they know the jobs that are available. So things like that, I think, help, but it doesn't necessarily give you the kinds of database and statistics and metrics that you asked about. But I think that's the best I can do.
So pragmatically, I think related to that, one is that we're trying to build our own capacity in this space. So that means as community colleges, we're having to redirect our own internal resources. So instead of hiring X position, I need to build research capacity. I'm going to redirect the positions in that area. Secondly, we're outsourcing it. Plain and simple, we're going to find people who can collaborate with us, who have competency, outcomes they can demonstrate and say, hey, we can bring the skill set to you and allow you to be able to help purchase that from you and contract it as a service. We're doing that. Third, we're trying to figure out how can we get regional partners who can come together and help us say, here's where this space is. Fourth, we're pushing the government. You're asking us to say you want this type of data from us. The reality is that there was a great piece today about the FAFSA. You know, the certain parts of the FAFSA we just shouldn't have to fill out because the IRS already has this data. It's kind of the same thing. You're asking us to present this type of data. The reality at the end of the day is that you should be able to provide it to us and help us do the analysis around it. So I think those are some of the spaces we're doing that work in. And the last one is that I have a business roundtable where I bring business leaders together, and one of them actually said, Deering, I'll do that for you. And that, to me, was a very powerful conversation to build that capacity, that there's a deep investment in our success because they already have the business metrics and know-how to do that work to be able to help us bring that model into what we do.
Okay, we're out of time on this panel. We're going to move right into our next panel, but a great job. I want to thank Dr. Carter, Dr. Pollard, and Congressman Sixman.
Thank you.
Mine work as well. And that one matches my lipstick.
Thank you.
Oh, try and put it right. Okay. Go for it. Thank you.
Four or just three?
I think there's
one more.
No, there's four.
One more. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm
Walter Sigenthaler. Nice to meet you.
Oh, okay. How thirsty are you? Maybe I'll know.
I was hoping.
Did you want any water? Because I think they might need to grab another glass for you. Could we get another water glass? And then that last that one is
30?
From the.
Those are clean.
These two belong to you guys?
Yep.
Yep.
Thank you. I'm going to start off with you
So when did you come in?
Last night. I was actually at dinner at the Swiss Embassy last night. Because today there is an agreement signed between Switzerland and the U.S. about supporting apprenticeships.
Yeah, I've worked on our, we have a German model program. We have a German model program. Keep them here so we can watch the time.
Do you mind if I leave mine here?
No.
I don't.
Try not to talk too much about that. Okay, let's get started. Hi, I'm Patricia Cohen. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. I cover the national economy. I'm very pleased to be here with this panel. I won't go into the introductions because because you have them all here, but let me start with our host and sponsor, John White, who is the president of TACO, located... TACO.
Yeah.
If
you buy it, you can call it anything you want.
Okay, great. It's a $200 million manufacturing company. Then we have Amy Sell over there, who is running Community Ventures in Michigan, which is focused on getting some of the most disenfranchised into jobs. And then at the end, Walter Siegenthaler, Datewyler, right, executive vice president, did I pronounce that correctly, of the Backstatewyler Corporation. And I'm very interested to see that you actually worked as an apprentice in Switzerland, and that's one of the topics that I hope we can cover today about apprenticeship. So, but let me start, and I'm going to start with you, John, because we were talking about some of the skills gap before. It's an issue we hear about. We certainly write about it a lot in the media. But let me ask you first, is part of the problem a skills gap, or what we're really talking about is a pay gap? Is one point of view is that employers really, part of the problem is just not offering high enough wages. And so that a lot of the talk about a skills gap and increasing the labor force is perhaps tactical in a way of keeping wages down. Is that fair?
I think it's a combination of both. I think there's a problem in both areas. First of all, on the wage issue, it's disappointing to me to see how companies manage their wage structures. Because on the public side, you know, we're looking for the lowest possible wages, right? On the private side, we invest in the people. I think there's a significant difference. I've always believed and taken the approach that the last thing I want to talk about is wages. So, you know, our wage structure is pretty good. On the skills gap, and I don't think everybody shares my attitude on that. On the skills side, this has been an ongoing debate, and I think has become much more of an awareness point recently. Look, there's a skills gap when companies like mine invest in process, productivity, technology, robotics, automation for growth and stability. So the choice then is to place people or train them. And perhaps, in my opinion, the most underappreciated fact is that our greatest changeable, improvable asset are our people. So I've always had the opinion that we just need to train them and forget all the rest. So there is a skills gap. We need to close it. And the way to do that is through workplace education and training.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to you in terms of some of the best ways you think of doing that. But first, Amy, let me ask you, because you're actually running one of these programs now in Michigan. And in the last panel, it was interesting to me because two of the issues that came up were about flexibility and about PR in a way, publicity. And it's interesting to me, I've written about the for-profit industry, college industry, and we're all aware of some of the really terrible predatory practices that it's engaged in. But one of the things it's done quite well, one is marketing, and also one of the wraps is that they're have at least positioned themselves to be more flexible, perhaps, in community colleges. And I'm wondering if, in your experience in dealing with community colleges in Michigan, those two things have been a problem.
Great question there. The community colleges are a great system for access points. The credentialing is key. The access points are great. But one of the biggest issues that we've had in Michigan, too, is just getting people that are prepared enough to go into community colleges that don't need remediation, which kind of bumps a lot of people out. So some of the challenges that we've had on the market, all the marketing side has been key, trying to drive people into the right occupations that will provide that return on investment, that will get them the right kind of skills that they need, and to deal with all the other issues around getting the right kind of training and matching it. And it is a marketing issue. Those are huge. I think anything we can do to get people in the door is important, but also making sure that it's aligned and it meets the employer's needs is key.
Just to follow up on that, so is one of the issues you're saying is remediation, that really it's so many failures in the public school system previous to community college that these people, by the time they get there, really aren't even prepared for that level?
Yeah, there's in my experiences, too, running state programs for Michigan and being a part of workforce and economic development for 10 years in Michigan, which has, we had 10 years ago, we had so many issues on the recession. We had huge population declines. But then our manufacturing industry came back so quickly that we truly did have a skills gap in addition to the wage gap. And we were looking at 100 different specific talent problems and how to address them. I'm on a committee now looking at how we increase credentialing for adults to get it to some of the around 60%. There's a lot of initiatives going on right now in states, in Tennessee with the free college to try, how do you really get everyone up to a credential point? The view is to have a little middle class lifestyle. You have to not only have a high school degree, but something afterwards, whether a PhD, master's, two-year degree, apprentice, some type of industry-recognized credential is really viewed as the way to a living-class lifestyle. But to get there, there are so many different issues. There's the marketing issues. We don't have enough counselors in high school directing them, so we came up with a career jumpstart program to provide better information about high-demand jobs that don't require a four-year degree to get into high schools to drive them to go into the programs. We address the equipment issues by doing a $50 million bond to get more equipment in to the colleges to address some of the issues that were brought around funding for colleges. There's around a lot of it, too, is investment by the employers. How do we get the employers at the table? So we did a German model apprenticeship program to try to address that issue. But then also the program with Community Ventures is finding people that have so many barriers around education or employment or a felony record or disability. How do you even get them into the career pathway? And so for them, it's basically a job first, addressing their barriers. But then to really move up from, taking somebody who is in an area of economic despair, and how do you get them to stability by that, $11 an hour, $12 an hour job? But again, to get to the point of middle class lifestyle, a living wage, which we learned in Montgomery County is $80,000, to get to those living wage jobs, you have to have some additional training, is my belief. But sometimes it needs to come after that person has already found an employer, like a wonderful employer like John, where they're going to take that initial step and get them the work experience, change their trajectory, surround them by people that can give them hope and potential and a pathway, and then you address the additional literacy or GED or high school and then industry-recognized credential programs to really propel them.
So let me just stop you there to go to Walter to pick up on one of the points you made about apprenticeship, which is something that the president has talked about. I think even as we're here, there's a press conference going on over at the Commerce Department announcing an apprenticeship agreement with Switzerland. There was one signed last month with Germany. You've actually been through one. So what are, and there's been this apprenticeship initiative that's been going on for years, and yet it doesn't really seem to have caught on here. And why is that? What are some of the cultural barriers, if that's what it is, or is it other economic barriers that seem to be standing in the way of that?
Obviously, there are a number of barriers there, and we heard some in the first panel already that there are barriers out there. And it starts out, yes, in school, counselors, there's still counselors around, they say everybody has to go to a four-year college. So that is definitely one thing. Parents, and you know, we are located in North Carolina. In the past, was a lot of textile, and also textile is gone. A lot of the parents lost their jobs because manufacturing disappeared. So they don't believe in manufacturing. So it's a whole gamut which really we have to keep working on it. And we have an apprenticeship program called Apprenticeship 2000. We started that 20 years ago, and we are still putting in a lot of effort and really promoting it, marketing it. We are working very, very close with the schools, high schools, to find apprentices. And it took me quite some time. Of course, we were in it already, but then I went to a presentation at a session in Charlotte, and somebody presented the German model. And they said, well, and if students finish school, they look for a company to make an apprenticeship. I said, wow, that's where the difference is. Here, we as a company have to go and look for apprentices, and we put a lot of effort into that just to overcome all those barriers of about the 3Ds of manufacturing being dirty, dark, and dead. So we do a lot of effort, put a lot of effort into that and bringing it out to the people. Yes, I have to say over the last few years, we get a lot more support. There's a lot more being talked about, obviously also through the administration really pushing apprenticeships. I hope it's going to make it easier. We have been able to actually create two other programs in North Carolina modeled according to Apprenticeship 2000, and there's another one starting this fall. So, yes, there is something happening, but apprenticeships is definitely not a household word yet.
Mm-hmm. John, let me go back to you, and you were talking about training. From your point of view as an employer, is the best training coming in terms of a partnership, let's say with a community college, or is it running your own kind of program on site where you're actually training the people yourselves, and which is how many apprenticeships do work in Europe, where it's actually the employers are the one who are kind of running the program?
Yeah, from my perspective, and again, it's my perspective, not necessarily agreed with by everybody, but I view a company such as mine as having a significant social responsibility to the livelihoods of the individuals who are either working with us or around us, suppliers and customers. So we've chosen to take our workforce over the last 20 years, and as opposed to replacing them, to train them. And we do it in-house, on-site, all the way. By the way, what started out as simply a work job-related, job skill-related program, blueprint reading, gauge reading, basic manufacturing things, has become a program that now extends itself up through an MBA program in-house for our employees. And summer camps for the children, and et cetera, et cetera. But the point is to make this a real community in which people can take part. And now, do we do it ourselves? No. All of our education, for the most part, all of our education is provided by either high school, community college, or college professors. So we're not distracting ourselves with trying to teach people what we're not professionally trained to do. We do it but we have chosen to do it in-house. Although I see and have seen, and I was very interested in that first panel discussion. I have been really interested in watching the sort of redefinition of the community college system and the tech school system, because these institutions have really found, and I think your point was probably underappreciated, because you've always been doing this, but it's become so apparent that the redefinition of community colleges and tech schools has been to supply or provide an opportunity for these transitional people, as well as people who don't know what they're doing when they come out of high school, but to be able to train themselves or reacquaint themselves with what they don't know or want to re-know, I guess, so that they can be gainfully employed.
Now, how responsive did you find, at least when you first started, the community colleges were? I did a story a few months ago about welding programs in Texas and the community colleges. And it took a few years for the employers who talked about getting the community colleges to actually change their training and offer the skills that they needed and the kind of training that they needed. Did you have that issue? Was there this kind of lag between what was being taught or making the program respond to exactly the kind of training that you needed for your company?
I'm going to take that over to the tech school side for a second.
Okay.
As well, look, again, this is a little bit odd. I'm from Rhode Island. It's a strange little place, and it is little. So we have but one thing we do have is an outstanding, probably as good as any state in the country in education system, in terms of the college and community college network. So they tend to like to grab onto things quickly, you know. So if there's a way for them to contribute to preserving jobs in the state of Rhode Island, particularly in the manufacturing area, I think, I have found them to be very willing to quickly take part.
Mm-hmm. Amy, some of the population that you're dealing with in your program is much more difficult, and there's a lot of other issues that a lot of support services that they need. Should community colleges, you know, they're serving so many different populations. Are we essentially asking too much of them to, you know, serve as this kind of bridge, perhaps, to four-year colleges, to do vocational training, to do kind of remediation of 12 years of public school that aren't bringing them up to do all these certificates and some of the things that we heard on the first panel? We also know the completion rates at community colleges are quite low.
Yes. No, I do think we're asking too much of them. And a lot of the points that have been made have been coming up in these conversations, especially about the adjunct faculty. We have on this committee that I discussed, we have a representative from the union, and that is definitely the issue that they're focusing on is the cost structure. But there's the funding issues, and that's a whole another ball of wax about how do you fund programs. There is what they get from the K-12 system. So leaving the population that I am working with on Community Ventures outside of this piece, I mean, we are just asking too much of them. And especially in Michigan, there's funding issues of about do we put the money in the K-12 and really enforce rigorous graduation standards so people can come in, and how do you address that? Or do you provide more remediation services, there's how the funding flows, that's a mess. I love the model where in Michigan we've done a lot with middle colleges and early colleges where it's basically, you know, you graduate after 13th grade with an associate's degree. And, you know, from 9th or 10th grade, you're dual enrolled between community college and your high school. And these really are taking off. And there's some where industry is very much involved. There's apprenticeship pieces rolled into it. And for, I don't know exactly how they make it work, but it's free for those students. And so and they make it work with some incentives and policy changes between the community college system and the K-12. But I think those are beautiful because they address accessibility. They're industry recognized. Usually they graduate with with that credential and the associate's degree. So I think those programs where you can really make sure these incentives are lined up between K-12 and community colleges offer a great opportunity for success.
Mm-hmm. Walter, let me go back to you in terms of asking you about what are, let's say, the two or three main or primary improvements or things that we need to do to really widen acceptability of apprenticeship programs?
I think we go back to what was discussed in the first panel already, marketing. It's bringing the word out that, and it's not just about apprenticeship programs, but, you know, we as a manufacturing, as a manufacturer, advanced manufacturing, what is it? It's exciting. It's a lot more, and a lot of people just have no idea. And I have discussions with the Department of Labor and all the way to the top of Secretary of Labor, and unfortunately there is no real plan, and I think there is no funding available. That is one of the problems. And we as a small manufacturer, a company with 100 people here in the U.S., we can't do that. Mm-hmm. We can only do it very local, And we do as much as we as it's possible to brand this, to show people that an apprenticeship is not a second grade education. I think that a lot of people still look at it when they hear apprenticeship, oh, that's for the ones who don't make it, as was discussed mm-hmm. before. And but we feel or we see that when once we get the parents involved and show them what our program is, because we pay for the tuition at mm-hmm. the community college, of course they are paid while they are working, and we guarantee them a job at the end. They graduate with an associate's degree in mechatronics. What else do you want? I mean, it can't get much better than this. And it just takes a lot of time to get the point across. And as I said, it's very difficult to find the students who really want to do that. They're out there. There's no doubt about it. And I always say, every one of our apprentices could go through four-year college. No question in my mind. They're smart enough. That's the people we are looking for. Mm-hmm. But we're looking for the ones who like to work with their hands. Mm-hmm. And actually, most of them, what we pick, they say, well, I didn't really want to go to a four-year college. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad I found this, because, but I wasn't aware of. I think that awareness is the biggest problem we have.
Well, we've been talking a lot about young people, and obviously, you know, the millennials, right, is a generation finally that's actually exceeded the boomers in terms of size. But, you know, one of the mysteries that has been going on in the declining labor force participation, particularly among men of prime age working years, 25 to 54. So one of my questions to you is, are you only looking for young people? Would your apprenticeship program, or ones that you're familiar with, be willing to try to draw back perhaps older workers who were in the workforce, perhaps in, you know, a different kind of manufacturing job? Or is that really, at that point, does retraining become very difficult?
It's a little bit difficult, because the way we 20 years ago, we decided to structure our apprenticeship program basically according to the European model, and I wouldn't just say German, but German, Swiss, Austrian, because we are a group of companies working together. And so that's why we decided it's a youth program. That's how it is done over in Europe for hundreds of years or whatever. Let's do it the same way. There is nothing wrong with retraining older employees. There's no question about it. The problem is, if you take an older employee and put him into an apprenticeship program, the salary structure doesn't really fit very well. But that doesn't mean we can't train. And we had a typical case. We hired last year, in the second half of last year, we hired, I think, 10 machinists. We needed to add a second shift, and we had to hire people. We just could not find the people with the right skill. We hired them, and it turned out, even though the resume, interview, everything was well, but then once you put them on a machine, they were not performing. No. And our manufacturing manager said, well, I can't use them. I said, hold on. Pick at least the ones you think they have a potential, and we have to train them, because if you send them again, we're not going to find anybody else. Mm-hmm. There's nobody else out there. I'm sorry. We have to do the training. So it's less formal, but we still have to bring them up to the standard, to our expectation.
And how did that work?
It works because he was ready to quit second shift because he didn't have the people, and now suddenly it all works. But we had to push him there because it's... And that's a tendency here in the U.S. compared to Europe. It's a lot of short-term thinking. They're just, okay, now I need it. You have to do something. And the apprenticeship program, our program is a four-year program. Well, do I know what requirements we have in 4 years? Not exactly. But I plan on growing, and I know we have a whole bunch of people that are going to retire, so I have to bring new people in. There's no other way. Otherwise, I have nothing. And there's quite often the question about apprenticeship program. People ask me, what's the ROI? I laugh at them. I said, I don't know. I don't care. Because if I don't do this, I may not be in business in 10 years from now.
John, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, no, this is really, it's music to my ears. Because, look, I think one thing you're saying, Walter, that without saying it, is kind of what I said earlier, and that is our people are our greatest asset.
Yeah.
And they're the one thing that we can look, a computer's obsolete the minute it goes off the shelf. A car's obsolete when it goes off the lot. But people are never obsolete. And I'm going to tell you, people want to do good. They need the opportunity. And that's why I talk about a community. And that's what my company's all about. Everybody's different. I've just taken that road. And I want to tell a story just quickly about why sort of this is the subject for today. About 6 or 8 months ago, I don't know if anybody else in this room saw this, but there was a headline front page article in USA Today about a company. I'm not sure I have all the facts right, but I never do. But there's a company in Wisconsin that employed 1,000 or 2,000 people. And they supplied the auto industry with something. And it was not a huge town. And so the retirement rate from this company was greater than the, what do you want to say, the replacement rate, right? So they were actually thinking of closing this place, which would have devastated the town. So the company got together with the town and went to the high school. Now, our parents, my parents' generation, were pretty emphatic that we should not go into manufacturing because it was dark, dirty, and dead, right, or whatever you said. So so we all went to college, and we incurred student loans, and we all know the whole story. But this company went to the town and got together with the high school and began bringing in juniors and seniors and their parents to the company. And here's what happened. The parents said, wow, that's not what we remember manufacturing as looking like. And the kids said, holy mackerel, this is like a video game. And I want to do this instead of going to college. So the company convinced them that they could come to work there, make $80,000 or $100,000 a year, whatever it was, and still they would educate them. What a great move. You know, that's a community. It's all about that.
Amy, I'm assuming that you work with various employers in Michigan. John here, obviously, he's you know, sponsoring this panel. So we know you have a social conscience and you talk a lot about community. Is that your experience with the employers that you're, you know, we seem to have like two kind of visionary business yes. leaders here. But is that what you're hearing from all the employers you're
It's definitely a mix. And it's great when we have visionary employers. And there are a number of them in Michigan. So Fred Keller with Cascade Engineering brought together a group of employers to help train the population that we call structurally unemployed, people that have education and workforce barriers, and created a consortium of employers where they would enter in one employer and maybe work at $8 an hour making butter balls. And then they might work up into his company where there were more machinist jobs and then eventually engineering jobs. So it was a nice kind of a group approach that does provide that return on investment. You do by investing in people, you're going to retain them longer, they're going to have skills and grow. But also in Michigan, there's been a dynamic over the years of right during the recession, you could get highly trained, amazing people for free almost. And then when the manufacturing swung over, everyone that was still in Michigan was very gainfully employed that had the skills. And so then the bright employers, and a number of them, we did have a number of companies that came together and formed a consortium to train and invest like this. And so we had a small group of employers that were really willing to do the investment, but a lot of them were so used to either government providing the training or them not needing to do anything to get good people. And when the transition switched, we would hear a lot of, you know, whining about the employee, you know, government should solve this problem for us. And the smart employers and the ones that really could see the return would invest. And the line would be like, well, what if I invest in all my people and then they leave? And then the other conversation, well, what if you don't invest and they stay? So when the pain for businesses gets great enough, even if they don't have a social conscience, they will usually make some changes to stay in business. But there's a huge gamut that we've seen in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, and now to return to this issue of wages, which is something that you brought up, is that, you know, did we get into a situation, we've seen wages stagnate now over more than a couple of decades, but certainly coming out of the recession where wages have been pretty depressed. You said you could kind of practically get any talent. And is there just this, again, are we seeing just this reluctance of employers to offer higher wages after a period where they didn't have to?
It's been changing, again, because of the pain points, and we are starting to see increase in wages. It's really a supply and demand issue. Although in some industries, for instance, truck driving, which gets a lot of press, and I've had a group discussion with about 30 truck driving employers at the state, there's still so many systemic issues in that industry that really raising the wages is just one component. Mm-hmm. But in general, I think we are starting to see that because of supply and demand.
One thing that also happened, I didn't mean to. One thing that also happened after the recession in 2008 was people realized with the downsizing, particularly the financial institutions and the insurance companies like that. I sat in this room one time and made this comment that we were in 2009 that we were going to see a jobless recovery. And in fact, we were there before that because as we invested in productivity, we didn't need to hire more people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've grown the business from $30 million with 500 people to $250 million with 500 people. Important thing is they're the same 500 people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think investing in them as you go, the payback, you want to talk about ROI, I don't allow that to be talked about in terms of our education program because I think it would cheapen it. But I'll give you the statistic. Our turnover rate at Taco on 500 or 600 people is less than 0.5%. So that's in an industry with an average of 30%.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the ROI. Do the math.
Yeah.
Walter, your thoughts
on
that?
Well, I think, you know, the salaries, it is an issue because obviously every manufacturer tries to keep their costs down. But on the other hand, if I have a properly trained or skilled person, I much rather pay them $5 more an hour because they're more productive than if I have somebody that doesn't measure up to par. So it's really, it comes back to the training. And you started out talking about the skills gap. The question is, do we have a skills gap or is it a training gap?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think
Bingo. It's
more of a training gap.
Yep.
If we do the right training, we can get the people there. And if we have the right trained people, that means we have the skilled people, we can afford to pay more.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't afford to pay high salaries to people who don't perform well.
Right, right. And in your experience, let me pose you the question that I was asking John about in terms of doing your own training versus a kind of partnership with a community college. From your point of view, what works better?
Well, obviously with the apprenticeship, we do the hands-on training at the company, and that's all. It's the first year, most of the apprentices we take in are actually seniors in high school. So the first year, they still have to go to high school half a day. The other half a day, they work at the company. And then the second through the fourth year, they go one day a week to school. We work together with Piedmont Community College, and I have to say we have an excellent, excellent relationship with them. Mm-hmm. They really responded. Well, 20 years ago when we put this thing together, they didn't really know much about it either.
Mm-hmm.
But they really coped with us, and they do what we need. CPCC runs special classes for us. They adapt their schedule for us. And it starts with scheduling, just a little thing. You know, they may offer a lot of the classes we need for our apprentices already, but one class may be on Monday, two on Wednesday, another one on Friday. That doesn't work for us. So they have to schedule that our apprentices can take all the classes they need in one day,
mm-hmm.
and they have to make sure that all our apprentices, not just from Detweiler, but from the other partner companies within Apprenticeship 2000, get into those classes. And maybe a quick word about why a partnership. We only take two apprentices per year. Well, if I go to CPCC or even to a high school and say, well, I'm looking for two people, I have two people, they laugh at me. It's not enough momentum here. But as a whole, with Apprenticeship 2000, we can fill a whole class at mm-hmm. CPCC, so they can do something special for us. And that's the key to it. We alone could not have done this. There's no question.
So do you think that these kind of agreements that the government is engaging in, whether it's with Switzerland or Germany, that the government can, you know, provide the kind of momentum and organization that's needed to create these kind of partnerships, or is it something that really business needs to do itself?
Well, everybody has a piece in there. But to me, an apprenticeship program has to be industry-driven because you have to have the industry, the employer, who is willing to get going. The rest of it, to me, is easier to get going. There's still stumbling blocks, as I said, parents and educators and so on. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have industries who sees that they have a need to do that, it's not going to work. Government is not going to be able to put it all together and provide it. That's not going to happen. The agreements with Germany and Switzerland, I think they're going to help. And what I see is over the last, especially the last 6 months, 12 months, is a lot being talked about apprenticeships. And maybe because I'm so deep into it. I hear it every day. I hear something. But I think it's really, there's a lot happening. And as I said before, I have really good contacts with the Department of Labor. There is an enormous amount going into it right now to promote apprenticeships, to get it going. And that's going to make it easier for us because then we don't have to do as much selling because mm-hmm. people already know about it. And I hope I will see the day when students are coming and knocking on our door and say, hey, I want to make an apprenticeship. Do you have an opening?
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably not going to make that, but...
chime in maybe briefly on that piece too, because in Michigan we did have a consortium approach with government, industry, and colleges. And it was very challenging, but we had great leadership for our employers, which is absolutely key.
Yeah.
We also, because so many employers were at the table, the colleges were willing to make the changes because a lot of them were like, yeah, we've heard this before. We design a program. Nobody gets hired, and it's a loss for the colleges. So, but with enough employers, you can get the colleges to change. And government was good, I think, because we were able to show some credibility. We could tap into some of the other programs in high schools and colleges and do the marketing. But the industry was very clear, and this was an approach that our governor went to Germany, came back and said, we need a German model program, and we're like, okay, we're on it. And we brought those employers in, but they were very clear, okay, government is changing. We cannot rely on government. We've got to get this thing out of government's hands as quickly as possible, make sure it's industry driven. So I think those three components are key, but without the industry really leading it and putting the skin in the game, it's not going to be as effective.
Mm-hmm. And I think government can help to get more industry involved because what I have seen in North Carolina, in the three programs we have running right now based on Apprenticeship 2000, the majority of the companies are European-based. It's a lot easier to sell to them because they know what it is.
They're familiar with it.
And they don't ask about an ROI because they just do it. So we just have to get more American companies involved and really get them to the point that they realize they have to do something. The government is not going to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm going to throw it open to questions, but I just want to, John, to get your, you know, you speak to other business owners. Obviously, this is something that you yourself has invested in. When you talk to other entrepreneurs or business owners, is this something that they are open to, or does it sound so alien to them that there's a lot of resistance?
Apprentice programs?
Yes,
yeah.
or other variations on these kind of training programs that isn't immediately looking at the, you know, the return on investment in the short term. It
right back to the public versus private company thing. The public guys are generally looking for the quick
next quarter.
Next quarter number and the ROI. Guys like me are investing in our people. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't want to keep repeating this. It's a community. Of wonderful, wonderful people who I love with all my heart and soul. I'm going to invest there
right. So
that we can stay there and together. The people around me, I see, by and large, want to do this kind of thing. Because this whole discussion has evolved over the last few years, I think, a long way from where it was in terms of the reemergence of manufacturing and therefore the need for reinvestment in the people side. And I think people, companies all over, are seeing the value of it. So I think... much more receptive. And the apprentice thing is something that is beginning mm-hmm. to gain momentum, but I don't think we as Americans fully understand mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. It's a cultural difference that we have, right? And unfortunately, because it's a great program.
Right. Because one of actually, when I was thinking culturally, is that probably one of the knocks is that it's very narrowing or limiting to people young in their career who may not know exactly what they want to do yet. And if they go down this kind of tunnel, can they not get out?
Well, I think there is also the misunderstanding. A lot of people think an apprenticeship is just a dead-end street. You make an apprenticeship and you're stuck in there. Well, as you said in the beginning, I made an apprenticeship in Switzerland many, many moons ago, and I'm not out in the shop on a lathe on a milling machine anymore. But I have the basic understanding. I know what it's all about. And there are plenty of opportunities. To me, I always say an apprenticeship program, that's a foundation. And if you have a solid foundation, you can build on top of that whatever you want. You can go in any direction. Mm-hmm. And a real typical example, we also have apprentices as welder fabricators. We had one graduated, I think, about 4 years ago, worked for us. And about 2 years ago, we were looking for a service technician. Of course, a service technician has to have mechanical, electrical, hydraulics and everything. And he said, I would like to travel a little bit. And since we are running all our apprentices, so there's a mechatronics program at CPCC. Mm-hmm. He already had some electronics. He was in our electronics department. That's just part of the of the apprenticeship program. We don't just teach welding fabricating. Uh-huh. We give him a much broader thing. He qualified. We gave him some additional training in electronics. And off he went as a serviceman. And now he's actually transitioning into sales.
So
doors are open.
Oh, okay, so let's open it to the audience. If there's any questions, raise your hand. We've got microphones on the end there.
Yes, hello. My name is Annette Berghoff, and I would just have a brief question concerning exactly these career paths that then open up in industry. You said that for the more European-based companies, it's not a problem if you have an apprenticeship and then you go on to higher levels. What is it like for the U.S. companies? Would you say that apprentices at some point will hit some kind of glass ceiling where people will say, if you want to progress further, you will need a college degree? Or would you say that U.S.-based companies are as open and will allow these career paths?
And I think that depends on where you want to go. Mm-hmm. I not say that a four-year degree is wrong. But if you have a two-year degree, you can go on. And let's face it, if I look for an engineer, and that engineer has made an apprenticeship before he got his degree, I'm probably going to hire that one. Because that person has experience. Mm-hmm. That engineer also thinks about how am I going to manufacture that when they design something. So that's, again, it's another path which is open. And we have apprentices, once they graduate, some of them immediately go on and get their four-year degree. Other ones may work for a while and then go. So all those possibilities are there. It's not a dead end.
Yeah, my experience in general with working with hundreds of employers is, in general, yes. But there are going to be some jobs that require specific degrees and skills. But in general, if someone comes in and they're working really well on the line, those are transferable skills. They can usually move up into a supervisor position. They can get some additional skills and training or an apprenticeship to move into a skilled trades position. If they really want to go into an engineering or designing work, if they're already doing well at a company, many times those employers, again, they want to keep them. They want to invest in their good employers. So they will put them through a night program to get additional training and a degree to move around. So I see a lot of fluidity in American companies.
Yeah, you know, just to that point, there are jobs that require a degree. An engineer, generally, to put a stamp on something for approval, needs to have the ability to do. It's like having a lawyer, an in-house lawyer versus a paralegal, right? I mean, there's a difference there. It doesn't mean that the paralegal isn't more qualified than most lawyers, right? but I think there is a place. In my company, again, I use talk about it like it's a little incubator, but I mean, there's a whole lot of people in the management end of the business now who were working with me in the plant years and years ago, and they're now product managers, sales folks, and you know, so if you invest in them, I'm telling you, people want to do good. Mm-hmm. They want to grow and prosper. They just need to be provided the opportunity.
And I think on top of it, there are higher jobs out there which a lot of companies think they need a special degree, but it's not necessarily. Mm-hmm. Sometimes
exactly.
Experience replaces that.
That's exactly
degree.
Right.
This woman over here.
Yeah. Good morning. My name is Rosemary Segero. I'm a president of an organization called Hope for Tomorrow, based here in Washington, D.C., and I'm also an entrepreneur. Okay. Looking at your discussion from the first discussion and the second, how do you look at working with international colleges, doing what we are doing? We've started a program from Take Care, teaching them to become entrepreneurs as they grow up to high school, to elementary, to high school, and to college. So how do you look at international part, looking at what you are doing, or what would you advise, like what I'm doing in Kenya and other African countries, like what you are doing, training and community colleges? Thank you.
I look at not only the education, international education environment, but also the business environment as being critically important. To your point about the whole apprentice issue is a good example of that, because we need to transcend these cultural barriers somehow, and one way to do it is to, I think, to be involved with the international community in general as we're part of it, not as if we're teaching it. I don't know if that answers the question at all, but that's how I sort of view that.
And you know, we can take imported or stole the system from Europe, let's say Switzerland in this case, in our case, kind of. But we also do an exchange. We started that last year. We actually took three of our Swiss apprentices. They came over here to the States for 3 months, and it was a wonderful experience. Not just for those three apprentices, but also for the whole company, for our company, the employees. They just embraced them, and that cultural exchange that happened, we had a morale boost.
Mm-hmm.
It was really great, and we have two more coming over, I think, next week, so it's mm-hmm. going to start all over again. We're looking forward to that, because I think it's a great thing. We're also talking about getting some U.S. apprentices over to our company in Switzerland. We still work out the school, because obviously while they're apprentices, they have to go to school, so we have to find a way. In Switzerland, they have a little bit more of a break in school, but the apprentices who were over here last summer, they had to do homework. They had homework assigned, and we're working with CPCC to see how we can do it, maybe even video conferencing into their classroom. Mm. Because I don't have a problem if we have apprentices over in Switzerland and they spend 1 day a week in an office, and because otherwise, if they would be here in the States, they would also go to school for mm-hmm. 1 day. So we're working on that. But I think it's important, because that cultural exchange, and I know it's cultures are a little bit closer between Switzerland and the U.S. than it is to Kenya, but just that, it made a big difference. And I know they still have contact, they're emailing and FaceTiming or whatever with mm-hmm. each other. That builds a relationship which is going to last.
Mm-hmm. Other questions in the audience? Let me ask you one here, which is, I want to go back to this issue of for-profit schools, which, even though the industry has certainly contracted a lot, you know, a lot of these schools are promising these kind of technical certificates and training and connections. I mean, are there any out there that are living up to the promise?
I'll throw one in. There's an example of Moran Ironworks is a company in Michigan that does very large scale welding. And they did go to their community college, but the curriculum, and they were just one employer, and so trying to align the curriculum was different, and they didn't offer enough really in-depth experiences on welding. So they created their own industrial arts academy up in this little remote area in Michigan. The students have to pay $12,000. They do help with some of the fundraising. Many of the folks that come out of that are hired by Moran Ironworks. But other ones, I mean, the program is so good, and the technical skills are so great that they learn, and they're learning from a master welder who does these amazing feats. And so it's actually paying off, but it's a high demand area. It's done by direction from industry. Mm-hmm. And you do get what you pay for. I mean, the students are getting amazing jobs coming out of that at $70,000 to $90,000 a year in high demand areas, and they have a wait list of people trying to go into the training program. So if all those components are in place for a proprietary school, I think you can find good success.
Mm-hmm. Question over there.
Hi, I'm Catherine McClellan with the Manufacturing Institute. I know that ROI has come up a few times, so I just wanted to give a quick plug for an ROI calculator that our organization's actually in the process or production stages of developing. So please keep us in mind as you're looking for that in the future. My question for the panelists is, a lot of issues with the community colleges, and we heard this in the last panel too, is that they offer these programs and then employers come and cherry pick them before they've actually completed the credential. And so that hurts the community colleges. It helps the employers, and I understand you need the people right when you need them. But is this a policy change that we can make, or do we need to think about how to change the definition of completion and what that looks like? Or I just want to get your opinions. Or do we need to have a conversation with the employers to really press them to stay or to let the
Yeah, good luck
finish.
With that. Yeah, I do think that changing the definition needs to match up so you can align colleges with what they're supposed to do. Obviously, encouraging the employers and the students to try to finish that credential is good for both of them long term. But I don't. Yeah, it's hard to really align all these different motivations sometimes.
Well, I mean, it's interesting going back to the last panel, which is we've have this kind of drive, which we see all across education, to kind of quantify success. And I think one of the things that comes up is whether completions is really the only measure of success, and whether isn't it equally successful to get somebody a job. And so the question is, how can we change or think about changing the statistical measurements in order to capture what most people would see as a successful outcome? And I know this was an issue with the welding programs that I did in Texas, that I wrote about in Texas, where they were saying the same things, where the employers were essentially hiring them before they finished. And from everybody's point of view, that was a success story, but not from their statistics.
On our side, of course, there is always, when I talk to other companies, they say, what should I do? Educate those people, and then they go to the competition. We don't see that, mm-hmm. because I think that that four-year apprenticeship program builds so much loyalty. Mm-hmm. Our apprentices, when they graduate, they don't want to leave. They want to stay with the company, and that goes back to the community. It's they feel like they're part of it, and they want to stay. So we don't have any contracts. We guarantee our apprentices that they get a job upon graduation, but they have no obligation to stay. If they want to leave the next day, they can. Mm-hmm. But our experience clearly is they're not leaving.
Mm-hmm. Can I just make one point, Tom, just real quick? You all are going to think I live in la-la land, I'm convinced, after I say this. But one thing that I view as an obligation in my company, our company, look, remember I said it's called TACO? TACO is not for everybody, and everybody is not for TACO. So at some point in time, people part ways, either by their own or not. My hope as a community is that if somebody leaves TACO, they are better for it and are capable of jumping to the head someplace else, and it's mm-hmm. come back to be the case.
I'm going to go here. I don't think you had a question before.
So I'm Tom Bailey from the Community College Research Center. I know there are cases when students are recruited out of classes and don't finish. I mean, I've mm-hmm. heard that ever since I've been studying community colleges, which is. But it doesn't. It's not a large enough amount to show up in data. I mean, there's still a strong benefit to completing either a certificate or an associate's degree compared to just taking some courses. Now, I don't, hidden in there may be some substantial number of people who are recruited out of their welding class before they finish. But I know there are examples, but I would be a little bit skeptical about this as a major movement or a major factor in talking about today.
I think the study that I've been focused on around getting credentialing is that there are quite a few people that have been identified. I don't remember the exact percentage of people that have some college experience, whether it's community college or they went to a four-year degree and dropped out. There is a large population around there, and devising strategies for them to somehow get that completion, I do think would help them be credentialed, and it shows a stronger workforce, especially in a local community that's trying to attract more businesses. So I do think there's something there, but how you get at it, especially if someone isn't employed and making a lot of money and they don't feel the need, is a challenge, I think.
Could I, Celeste Carter, could I add, just since I was the one who said cherry picking, I thought I should add that it was a very small percentage of the people that were in the program. And typically a year or maybe 2 years or maybe even three, they'd be back knocking on my door saying, I want to finish. So they saw the value, and usually the company they were working for paid for them to come back, gave them flexible work hours, allowed them to come back and pay their tuition so that they did finish, because then they saw that as being a more valuable employee.
And is that not necessarily a bad model, right, if people come back?
Right.
So I think we have time probably for one more question over here. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Mindy Reiser. I had the opportunity to evaluate vocational training programs funded by USAID in some developing countries. But my question is to John. You said something, I think, which is quite pregnant with meaning about public companies and privately held companies. And I'm wondering if this is really significant. In Germany, it's well known for these middle-range companies that are owned by families for generations, and there's a real investment in the people in the community. I'm wondering, when we're talking about mega corporations which respond to Wall Street and investment companies and hedge fund managers, if this is the same story, if we're really talking about a very different definition of what it is to own a business and what it is to care for the human well-being of your employees. I'd like to hear some thoughts on that.
Very briefly, yes, I think there's a huge difference, and I think it because I see it, and I see it up close and personal by evaluating the way we operate versus some of my competitors. I'm blessed with having competitors that operate that way, okay? because the loyalty is different than it is in not all of them. I don't mean all of them, but some, and the ones that I care operate that way. But I think there is a big difference because the whole driver behind public companies is the stock price. And that is only achievable in markets where pricing doesn't move that rapidly. It's only achievable by cost and in a very short term. I don't care about the short term. And I have the luxury of not caring about the short. I have to stay in business, but I can invest in where I see fit. And somebody called me a visionary. I never thought of myself as that. I just love people. And so that's where I've chosen to invest my time and resources. But public companies, big ones, generally don't have that luxury.
Well, actually, I have seen both. Siemens, big German company, actually was part of Apprenticeship 2000 for a while. And I think the reason was they wanted to get an apprenticeship program going, and they have a big plant in Charlotte, so obviously jumping on our bandwagon was the quickest way of getting it going. They, in the meantime, decided to do it at their own, but they still keep going with apprenticeship programs, so it's a positive separation we have there. On the other hand, we have one partner company, the local company that is in the partnerships, really wanted to keep going, and suddenly from the head office there comes the directive, well, we have to cut costs, no more apprentices. Hmm. There's nothing we can do from our little level here, because that came up from corporate. So, yes, there is. And typically, as John said, a public company has to make sure the next quarter is okay. The numbers are right for the quarter. Same, we are privately owned. If we lose money one quarter, okay, that's not that bad, as long as we know we are going to make progress. Mm-hmm. Nobody gets fired because we lose money because at the first quarter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, that's a good note to end on. Thank you all so much for participating in the panel. Thank you all. Thank you.
No. 5 pound water jug.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome. Coming to your own place. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hello. Already. And last but not least. Thank you.
Thanks. We haven't actually been introduced.
Yeah, John Colborn. Nice to meet you.
How's it going? You know, I know you're asking me there's something you said which I haven't responded to.
About the higher education.
Somebody else sent it, and then I guess I didn't
Mary
respond,
Alice.
And then you said,
it's a coordinated campaign.
I just came back from Europe.
So how long
were you
there for?
Yeah. Was it vacation?
No, it was a vet conference at Oxford.
Oh, nice. How does that work?
Talking about apprenticeship.
Apply for a job and you get hired at Brooklyn?
There's a lot going on.
I'd love to
debrief with you on that. We've got a little bit going on.
This is my third U.S. conference with a German or Swiss apprenticeship advocate.
They really are.
But it's interesting that that's what you got. Those are always the ones at the conference.
Yeah. Well, they're believers and they're evangelists.
And, you know, and they've got something, so I don't... anyway, I don't know. Of course, you know, I lived through it. I mean, I wrote a thing in 1983, Can Youth Apprenticeship Thrive in the United States?
Yeah. It's a great job, actually.
I was skeptical, but I was
not totally.
I all this work up in the school to work out like, yeah. Then half. With community colleges, I mean,
the news dictates a lot, you know.
And I just come back. I feel like Britain Van Lee.
You know, you can't tell.
Now, I'm trying to figure out.
Say, oh, I don't want to do that.
Anything has changed.
Yeah.
Now that option's not always available.
20 years later. And I'm jury's still out.
Sometimes a couple hours.
I would love to chat with you.
Right. More recently. Okay.
So. Happy to talk.
If everyone could take their seats. Grab your coffee. Come on, sit down. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Goldie Blumenstick. I'm a senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. And since I know some people have been tweeting today, Twitter handle is @GoldieStandard. We're going to conclude the sessions today focusing a little bit more on community colleges. I've actually been noticing, I think that there's a little bit of a Washington, D.C. lens on this discussion today, which I'm finding a little bit interesting. Everyone keeps talking about how we have this highfalutin notion of college. Let's remember that only 30% of this country has a bachelor's degree right now, and so I think we need to broaden our horizons a little bit about what we're talking about today. I was pleased to hear Congressman Cellini talk a little bit about the narrative changing around manufacturing. I would argue that the narrative is changing already about community colleges. The questions that this panel is going to take up today is, are they really living up to that? new reputation, not just in areas of marketing and getting the word out, but in actually delivering these kinds of good programs that we need to be talking about today. So I'm going to start with you all have introductions of our panel, so I don't need to do that for you. I'm going to start with Tom Bailey at my far right here, obviously a scholar of community colleges. Tom, do you have a Twitter handle?
Bailey CCRC or CCRC Bailey?
That's CCRC for Community College Research Center, so dig around for that. So can you just, we've heard a little bit about some of the kinds of things community colleges are doing. Can you just step back and briefly kind of give us an overview about the kind of training that community colleges are doing and, you know, just to give people, make sure they have a full spectrum of things rather than just sort of a haphazard?
Well, okay, so I think that one thing about community colleges is difficult to generalize. There are fabulous programs at some. Some community colleges have wonderful relationships with employers. We've heard some of those. Some of them don't. I think that's and it's very much a local issue. States involved somewhat, but I think it's where it works well is when the local presidents and leadership of the college is working with the local employers community, and that's great. But I want to say that the fact that we've heard some good stories and there's so much variation, I think, is a fundamental issue. Actually, Celeste was and I were at a conference that she mentioned, the National Academy of Sciences, on middle skills jobs, and I heard so many great things. I sort of left the conference saying, what's the problem? I mean, there's this program and that program, and we've heard that too. And that's true. I guess you could fill up a 2 or 3 day conference with fabulous programs, and we do that. But these aren't randomly selected people from the country who are coming to talk about that. And I think that a community college can absorb many of these individual programs without fundamentally changing. A majority of community college students go, they don't finish, they leave without degrees, many of them are stuck in remediation. So all of these problems continue to exist despite the fact that any of those institutions will have some great programs that we can talk about. And I think that's what I'm trying to summarize a book we just wrote in 2 minutes, Redesigning America's Community Colleges. And I think that, you know, the point you said is the fundamental design of the colleges is what we call the cafeteria model. There's a ton of stuff there, almost everything, some great things, whatever you want, you can get there, except you really have to find it yourself as a student. So the kinds of things that we wanted to argue is that first you have to have our programs have to be more structured, better designed, easier to understand. And in this case, I think this is relevant specifically, they need to be connected to wherever you're going, either subsequent education or to the labor market. And in that case, if there really are jobs of this type in your local labor market, those need to be tied to those programs. Now, I say if because I think in some cases there aren't, and I think we need to question, I think there's been some skepticism about the nature of the shortage of skills. So I think that's one thing. Now, the second point, somebody mentioned counseling, and in the typical counseling situation in the community college is a few minutes with the counselor when you come to register. Now, there's some other examples or there's some exceptions to that, but that's not going to be able to work but with a student to tell them about these wonderful opportunities or to allow them to really understand what it is they want to do and whether that will connect to the opportunities that they have. So I think it's much more than thinking about specific counseling or whether we need some more counseling. Yes, we do, but we need a whole different way of thinking about the intake process of a community college. It's not 10 minutes with the counselor off to the testing center where you're told you're not ready for college and you need to go to remediation. That's a little bit stark, but that's fundamentally the intake process that we have at community colleges, at most community colleges. Now, there are definitely exceptions. We've heard exceptions this morning, I think. So if we want to be able to connect these programs to employers, whether they're apprenticeships, whether they're good work-based training, whether there's a good program at the college, that will prepare people. So we need to develop better programs, better pathways into those programs, and we have to take much more seriously working with students to figure out what it is they want to do and how they can connect to those programs. So I think if we can do that, that will both, I think in general, address the overall problems that we have with completion in community colleges, but it will also allow us to, if there are issues with employment and manufacturing and there are opportunities there, a much more effective way to connect to those opportunities.
So John Colburn from Skills for the Future at Aspen. Do you have a Twitter handle?
John Colburn, yes.
Great, very creative one. So Tom's gotten us started on this topic a little bit here. You've mentioned to me when we were getting ready for this talk that to really be successful with this, the employers and the companies have to be really engaged with the colleges in a much more, not just at the presidential level, not just at even at the dean level, but really down to the faculty level. But yep. I think you mentioned faculty development, career advising, guest instruction, job shadowing, capstone projects, job fairs, interview days, all that stuff. Are the colleges even equipped to begin to do some of that stuff?
So, you know, just to build on Tom's comments, in my last job, I was at the Ford Foundation, worked a lot with community colleges, and I had a joke, I would say, that community colleges are expert at best practice. They can adopt it and then wall it away from the rest of the institution so it doesn't infect the rest of the college.
So they can do it in isolation.
Exactly. And so I think our challenge is exactly what Tom said. It is the whole school. How do you get these practices throughout the whole school? And I think there are probably three things that really drive that. One is we have the outcomes that we have in community colleges because public policy has been perfectly aligned to get those outcomes. So you want to have a community college where people start a lot of classes that then don't finish those classes, or start a lot of programs but don't finish those programs. Well, then let's be sure we pay people on enrollment, or pay the college on enrollment rather than on result, right? And so I think one thing that certainly we need to be looking at is how do you structure public policy in ways that gets to the kinds of results we want to see? Some of that is payment on performance, but some of that is also on the very governance of community colleges. If you have a community college governance system that is very inward-looking, that doesn't really take in perspectives from the community and from employers, then you're likely to get a certain result.
Is there a way to structure a governance policy around that, changing the culture about which way whether it's inward-looking or outward-looking?
So we're actually engaged in developing a reconnaissance across the states because the beautiful thing about community colleges is because they come in so many different shapes and sizes and are subject to 50 different state policies around governance. We actually want to look at what kinds of policies states can adopt that seem to sort of promote better engagement with communities, whether that's around how trustees are appointed or elected, whether that's around how outcomes are rewarded, whether that's around how funding is structured. So I think policy is certainly number one. The second thing, my colleague Josh Weiner at the College Excellence Program at the Aspen Institute would certainly say, is leadership. And so when you have a president who and a senior management team that really values outcomes for students and student success, that really focuses on community and employer engagement, you get certain results in the institution. Now, it's uneven to get the right leadership in every single community college, but we know that that has a significant impact. And I think the third thing, then, is that we need to start treating the processes around employer and community engagement as critical functions, every bit as critical as the bursar function, as the enrollment function, as facilities management. We need to really start having practices and professional development approaches that value that and that provide a sort of management structure, feedback loops within the institution to value that activity. And just another project we're engaged in right now is actually creating a benchmarking tool that can help community colleges and community college programs assess the level of employer engagement that they have. We actually think that measuring something is sort of the first step towards actually valuing it and making it a more systematic function.
Great. Adela Sleaze, Twitter handle, first of all?
Like John, it's uncreative. It's at Adela Sleaze.
There you go. You've been studying these programs a little bit, and I know you have some concerns about kind of the nature of the credentials or maybe the nature of the education that comes out of it. We've heard a little bit of this discussion earlier about whether it's a little bit too narrow, some of these technical certificates, some of the AAS degree. What's, I mean, how do colleges guard against keeping these degrees from becoming or certificates or whatever it is that they're offering as part of these programs, how do they guard against keeping them too narrow?
Right. I mean, I'm not sure there's a clear solution to guard against it yet. I think it's sort of, I'm sure that we could all as a group argue about whether this is even true. My concerns are sort of almost more research questions than concerns. I think one solution that I've seen, though, to potentially sort of giving people these narrow certificates that don't provide a foundation for future education or to deal with changing labor markets is the stackable credit idea.
So we all heard about this idea, stackable credits, a certificate that doesn't lead to nowhere, but it leads to something else. And I guess I think it's a very important part of the process, but I'd like to also hear from our panel about whether they think it's actually... Are most credentials stackable now? Do they do that?
I would say most are not. I think there's an aspiration to certainly build higher levels of stackability. Look, once upon a time, and I think there was this view that college education was sort of a single dose experience, right? So at 18, you got your dose of education, 4 years, and then you were sort of done. That was never exactly truly true. Mm-hmm. But I think that was sort of the perception. And I think we're now in the fastest growing area of higher education is the certificate, right? It's this shorter term credential. And I think that reflects a much more rapidly evolving set of skill needs and skill expectations. I think Americans have gotten the message that they need to be continually upgrading their own skills, sometimes with the help of their employer, which is great when that happens. And so I think that then demands that education providers have a mechanism of helping people map to that, so it's not just an ad hoc sort of episodic, go to the cafeteria, pick up the right, hopefully you're getting the right program. But I think practice certainly lags on that.
Yeah. The jury is somewhat still out on that. I mean, we already heard some examples about certificates where actually people are coming back with bachelor's degrees or master's degrees.
But that's not a stackable credential. That's a credential that you're coming back to get.
But what I'm saying is, if you're looking at, so let's say, a certificate, you want to think of a certificate as we think of an associate's degree kind of as something that leads to a bachelor's degree. Do certificates lead to substance degrees? In most cases, they don't, just empirically in terms of how many people get certificates and move on. And all I wanted to say about that was that in many cases, the people getting certificates already have bachelor's degrees, so there's a lot of people getting these, quote, lower-level degrees when they actually have the degrees. So I do think that the notion of stackable credential, which, by the way, one of the problems of getting older is that you hear the same discussion for a long time. I've been hearing this discussion for a long time, and I do think it's, at this point, much more aspirational than it is kind of a fundamental part of the education.
Which
system.
May be depressing if you've been hearing this discussion for a long time and it's still kind of aspirational.
I don't know. You can take that up with my therapist.
Adela, you want to go back to some of your concerns about these credentials. I know you've also had some concerns about the Associates of Applied Sciences credential.
Right. Actually, sort of related to the stackable credits and talking about certificates idea, I would like my fellow panelists' opinions on how well these credentials are understood across labor markets. We know that people are mobile. So is this effectively training a person who is attending their local community college but then moving to the next city to try to get, this job in welding or what have you?
Right, especially when these things are so employer-tied.
So I think we all have to acknowledge the credentialing system is completely broken. there is huge confusion among employers, among educators, and among students around just how all these things fit together. Right? We're at a stage right now where basically any Yahoo can put out a shingle and say, I have a credential, and maybe it's got labor market value, maybe it doesn't, maybe it's stackable, maybe it's not. There are many efforts now underway to try to impose some level of order or rationality onto that system. I think some of us know about the work at ANSI, the work cred system. Certainly the Lumina Foundation has put significant markers down to try to figure out how you rationalize this system. But it is a huge, huge problem. And one way I think you get around that is certainly something that we at Skills for America's Future are very big on, which is deep engagement of employers in the design, development, and rollout of those credentials. I think one thing that I like about apprenticeships is that they have been validated, at least by one employer and with some recognition either from the federal government or from a state government that in fact there's value to this apprenticeship, to this program.
Does that deep engagement also have to be sort of across an industry standard, not just a local company standard? I'm sort of thinking that might be a way to make some of these credentials a little more useful. That it's not just what this local company wants, but this is a standard that would also be something that will be, you know, more transferable.
Yeah, I think the issue of how employer organizations can work together is a major problem, really. And I think if we want to think about making apprenticeship much more broadly available and a kind of a more fundamental part of our education system, then we'll need to get employers to work working together more than they are now. So, I mean, I think that the issue about portability, I mean, one of the great strengths of the community college is its local relationships. There's no question about that. Those are great. They can be great. How then you connect that? I mean, I think as you go up the ladder of, you know, a bachelor's degree is more mobile, associate's degree are certificates since we don't really know what they are. And there's a huge amount of non-credit training, which is pretty much completely, not portable. The growth of certifications, the whole competency-based education. I mean, we don't even know the effects of certifications because we don't have we don't have good data on that. Yeah. So, yes, there's a lot of things going on there, and we're going to need to be able to understand that more because there's a lot of discussion about that. I think we're still in an institution-based education world. And I think that we can do a lot to improve those institutions and to make them function better. I think the thing about community colleges we have to remember, community colleges were set up to open education to wide groups of people at a low cost. They've been spectacularly successful at doing that. But the problem with designing a college that does that is it's not the same thing as designing one that is going to get students to the end and get students to the goals that they have. And if you have an open system where everybody can get what they want and easily enroll on any kind of a schedule at anything that they want to do, that's going to be difficult, and we simply don't have the advising capabilities to be able to manage people in this kind of chaotic situation.
It's too easy to get off track in that environment. You talked a lot about how these really need a deep employer engagement and employer engagement with the faculty. And to return to the point of the gentleman who raised it earlier, how can you really have that kind of deep employer engagement with faculty when we have such a high adjunctification level of colleges right now? I mean, if the faculty aren't there to... they're only paid per course.
I mean, somebody said this before. We have to, before I answer that question, have to emphasize, you know, we pay these institutions the least and they have the students with the most problems. So, you know, as the president said, that's the constraint that community colleges have. We see states completely getting out of the community college funding business cases. Right. And the fact is, I mean, it is.
But in other states, paying for it for free.
That's true. But we can argue that if you actually invest in more full-time faculty or more advisors, you can get your completion rates up. And so the cost completion might come down. Yeah. That's an important thing to remember. But of course, the colleges aren't paying for themselves on the cost per completion. They're paying on the cost per enrollment. And the things that we have to get those costs down tend to be the things which make it more difficult for us to have students to get to the ends that they want. And frankly, will make it more difficult to connect to manufacturers so that we can provide that kind of skill. So just, I mean, let's just, you know, take that as a given. We pay the least to the colleges that have the students with the most barriers. Now, I do think there are things that can be done with adjuncts. I do think there are things we can do under the current funding structure that we have. Certainly efforts need to be made to incorporate those adjuncts in. And as somebody said before, many of those adjuncts are actually, you know, practitioners of whatever it is they're teaching. So let's remember that it's not, you know, there's it's not just a bleak, plane of part-time teachers. There are certainly, you want some adjuncts there because they're actually current practitioners. But I do think it's a fundamental thing. If we really want to improve the performance of institutions, we're going to have to incorporate as much as we can the part-time faculty that we have.
I actually worked as an adjunct in one of these workforce development programs. So a way that we sort of overcame this high turnover rate, I mean, first of all, I should say I was a very lucky adjunct. We were unionized, so we were paid a good wage and we had benefits. So, I mean, you know, maybe the first part of the solution is to sort of at least partly get rid of the whole adjunct system.
The exploitation of adjuncts,
right. Mm-hmm. But we, as a faculty developing this program at the very beginning, in a way that sort of the for-profits do actually as well, creating curricula that we hoped would be able to pass down, you know? So even if I left that year, I had this core curriculum that I could give to somebody that was just starting this job, and hopefully they would be able to teach the course the same way that I taught it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are lots of things about that are not ideal, but it is a partial solution.
Yeah, I would think just even having the continuity with your corporate partners or those are harder relationships to maintain.
Right. I mean, those were higher up. You know, I wasn't the one that was getting to talk to the industries that we were creating courses for.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about measuring quality of outcomes. Not outcomes of the programs, and I think also making sure that colleges are investing their programs in fields where there's a good payoff for the wages. I know State of Kentucky has done some work in this area where they've in the technical college system where they've eliminated some programs that weren't in high-paying fields. But is there a state-of-the-art best practices about this right now that for what colleges are doing to make sure that they're evaluating their programs well and particularly looking for the programs with the right outcomes?
Well, I think once again, and at least for community colleges, it gets back to the local context, and in some areas, in some high population density areas, then there are lots of different employers, and so colleges can have a variety of programs that speak to that. You know, that there has to be. I mean, if they do have relationships to employers and are interacting with them, then they'll have a better idea of what the programs are that are necessary, whether their graduates are actually have the skills that are necessary. So I think that's a crucial element of that. Now, so colleges, community colleges have redesigned their programs in some cases. You talk about Chicago. That's an example of Chicago. They have a set of community colleges, the city colleges of Chicago, and they have they've specialized their programs in different areas in the city because there are different employers and concentrations of employers in those areas. So they've done that. They have reorganized their programs into broad areas, about 10 of them, let's say health or business. And those are designed in relationship to employers. So I think that's a crucial part of what they're doing.
Is there kind of a right way, wrong way to do that? Or are you saying it's really locally? I mean, is there a sort of a template for just even six? These are three good approaches to take. I'm just wondering, if they say, okay, well, we want to do a better job of measuring. How do they start?
Of course, measuring is different from doing, right? I think it depends on the nature of the business organizations that are in your local area. In some cases, if there's a German Chamber of Commerce or a Swiss Chamber of Commerce there, then you can work with them. If the employers are organized, that's a better situation. If not, then you're in the college. You're going to have to be doing some of that yourselves. To bring that together.
I think at our College Excellence Program, the Aspen Prize for Community Colleges really values two key outcomes. One is, the success of the student. Are they actually completing a program? And then what are the labor market outcomes for that student upon graduation or completion? You don't want to be completely reductive about that, and there certainly are other purposes that people go to community college. So I don't mean to say that that's the end-all and be-all of every measurement for every program at a community college. But I think you start there, and certainly, we know that there are pending regulation and regulatory proposals at the Department of Education that would start to roll that out. And I think you start there, and you can sort of start working around that. But to me, those are good places to start.
I think there's something else which we haven't talked very much about, which is the associate's degree, certificate associate's, or bachelor's degree. So now there are many programs that are that occupationally specific programs that in community colleges that were associate's degrees working with manufacturers, and now many of those jobs want bachelor's degrees. So I think it's important that maybe this gets back to the stackable issue, but it's important that we think about the future, that we hold open the options that students have so that they can go on and get their bachelor's degree in many of these areas. And I think that when you really think about what would work is, or what needs to work, and it's very difficult, is that you get the 2-year, the 4-year college and the employers together so that they can work on that. That's, there you have an opportunity to perhaps to make a stackable credential. I mean, nursing is kind of an unusual situation. I mean, many associate degree nurses go out and work and then they go back and get a bachelor's degree. So it's, you know, it's an unusual area, and it's highly regulated because of the certification required of the state. But if you want an example of how it is you want to build that, I think more things are going to be looking like nursing, perhaps not with the state regulation, but I think that's one model that we want to be able to do so that people can get their associate's degree, recognizing that many of those jobs really need more education.
And can I say one more thing, which is just I think our research understanding of the sub-associate's degree certifications is really limited. And I know the Department of Education is actually building up some new capacities now to be able to understand that better as a country, sort of where we are. But we really, you know, we have very little understanding of which of these certifications really seem to propel opportunity and which ones don't. If you look at the aggregate data, it kind of looks a little murky, bleak.
Data, I think, shows that there are advantages, but then you have to go dig and say, this certificate is good.
It has real advantages, right. And this one maybe is negative or has very little advantage.
Some could be very costly. And
we have actually Department of Education funded Center, CAPSE, Center for the Analysis of Postsecondary Education and Employment, and we are doing quite a bit on certifications. Short-term certifications, not surprisingly, aren't as valuable. In some cases, we can't see statistically significant effects. If you want to generalize, certainly health, if you look at the health certificates, they're all, you know, maybe much of the positive effect of certificates comes from health.
Since we're here about manufacturing, do we have any sense of what they are in manufacturing?
It's kind of difficult to do this, but I mean, generally what we find is that certificates will give you a bump in your earnings, but it won't change the rate at which the earnings grow. Whereas associate's degrees tend to not only give you a sort of a bump, but also change the rate at which they grow. So I think that's, but they're so varied, they're so different. It's, you know, you're really look at, you know, generalizing about certificates with a bit of anxiety.
So we talked a little bit about apprenticeships earlier today. I know there's been this new $100 million initiative from the Department of Labor. I'm not that familiar with it myself, but I'm wondering if anyone on the panel can say, were there aspects to that grant program that made it more attractive or less attractive to community colleges to be part of it? Is it something that's going to really give a boon to it? I kind of was surprised when I was doing my book how for all the noise about apprenticeships, how few apprenticeships we actually have in this country. That was a little bit of a shock to me.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you look at the level of investment that the country has made in apprenticeships, we have about the number of apprenticeships you'd expect, right, given that level of investment. So,
but to this thing in particular, will it really jumpstart anything at community colleges?
I think that I've emphasized the institutionalization concept here, and I think if we want to think about this as a broad thing, we want to think about what is the institutional structure that supports apprenticeship. We can have a number of apprentices from dedicated employers, especially employers who have experience of this. I mean, I don't think it's surprising that German and Swiss employers are the ones who are doing this. But I mean, if you think about the institutional structure that supports apprenticeship in Europe, you have very strong employer organizations that actually have authority and that people that work together. You have the unions, you have the social partners, and you have government involvement as well. So it's a triple partnership. And it seems to me that as far as in all of those cases, we're moving in this institutionally in the opposite direction. So we're going to have apprenticeships, but that's going to be based on dedicated employers who get together on their own without a strong institutional support. Colleges are perfectly happy to provide the classroom-based instruction for those, and I'm sure many of them actually do that. So they're there available to do that, but I think that, what are the wages that apprentices are getting? How is that regulated? What is the quality of the instruction that takes place? Are we going to have some kind of quality assurance procedure that does that? We've heard from employers today, and I'm absolutely sure that the quality of their apprentices is great. But if we want this to be a mass organization or a mass movement, then I think we need to think about that. So I'm sure we're going to get a growth of it. We have a lot of discussion about it. There's some resources that are put behind it. But I think we have a lot of other type of work to do if we want this to be something more than an interesting thing of which there are some excellent examples, but it isn't really going to grow. So that's my view of it.
I'll leave it with what Tom said.
One of the things that we haven't talked that much about is sort of the preparation level for community college students when they come in. And, you know, even when you're going into an apprenticeship program or a formal apprenticeship program, an industry-sponsored program. I think, John, you mentioned to me earlier that math skills, English skills can still be
huge
quite
barriers.
A barrier.
Yeah.
You've talked a little bit. Can you talk a little bit about the nature of the kind of remediation that colleges need to be thinking about? And again, are they in a position to provide that kind of remediation?
So, of course, Tom has studied this, so I'm going to defer to him on the stats. But I think certainly what we are seeing, those programs that seem to be most effective in both working with employers and then working with the student population base as it arrives at a community college, are those that seem to be able to embed remedial education of math and English into the instructional program, that do that rapidly and quickly, and that do that in a context that makes sure that the instruction, remedial instruction, actually relates to the field of study that the student is performing and is interested in. And if you do those things, we seem to see much higher levels of success. If somebody who goes into a traditional, isolated remedial program, particularly if they're one or two or three levels back, the odds of them actually ending up in college-level instruction are virtually zero.
No, I agree with that. I think that the prerequisite isolated remediation that you're supposed to take before you start college, I think that's what's not working. And that there's a variety of ways in which you can incorporate that instruction into college level. If it's a regular math or English, you can use a co-requisite kind of model where students are in the college level program but have some additional instruction or support besides that. I think that the occupational area, as John said, is one where there's tremendous opportunity for that, where you can really embed that instruction contextually into the types of things that you're doing. So you're not off doing a math course over there, the same math course you took in high school that you didn't do well in. You're actually engaged in doing activities on the job and then getting instruction in mathematics where that's relevant to what you're doing. So I think the manufacturing and other occupational instruction, many technical colleges here in the United States actually do that, where they have kind of just-in-time instruction for students who have weak academic skills. And that's, I'm much more optimistic about that. So, and I think in this particular topic of this meeting, I think is an area where there's a lot of potential for that.
So in this case, it actually could be the just-in-time kind of training could actually jumpstart and improve traditional remedial education as well at colleges?
Well, I think also having these basic skills courses embedded in these workforce training programs and certificates, I mean, that helps them move more towards being this foundation for future education.
Totally.
So I think it's really a win-win situation.
I have a lot more questions, but I know we want to get some time to get some folks in the audience. So I don't know if the microphone people are out there yet. There's the microphone people, and there's some questions. We've got both microphone people and questions. We have a couple right up here in the front. Woman in the red, I think.
Oh,
go ahead. We'll take a few.
Hello, it's Ariane Hegovich from the Institute for Women's Policy Research. I have a question about measurement and about training. The big issue on manufacturing and middle-skilled jobs is that there's such enormous gender segregation. You know, it's like in most of those jobs, it's less than 5% women, the growing jobs. And we know from Perkins, where colleges and K-12 have to measure how many women and men enroll in non-traditional occupations, that there is a huge variation between states of how much they get young women and men to do manufacturing, CTE in school, and then they drop, there's a big drop off, and then how much they do in college. So we were talking about marketing earlier. Firstly, can we integrate this issue of access for women more strongly into marketing? But the second thing is then we also heard they come, training hasn't changed, teaching hasn't changed, job, the workplace hasn't changed, and they think, why should we be here? We're not welcome. So I just kind of on measurement, on training, on teaching, how can we open manufacturing, good manufacturing jobs to women?
We're all looking at each other.
Yeah.
I know we've been talking about this a long time, and I'm not sure there's a good answer to that. I do think that, at least from the point of view of community colleges, if we have a more thought out and coherent a process for helping students think about what they want to do. I suppose it's perfectly possible that bias can go into that, and perhaps that, you know, that might reinforce gender segregation. But I think if men think that nursing is something they don't want to do and women think that being a machinist isn't for them, I think that, you know, we can certainly try to incorporate in the kind of entry work that we do with students to try to fight against those types of biases or stereotypes. I think that would probably require a considered strategy to address that, to talk with people who are engaged in that about trying to make sure that that they're not pushing that particular bias. But
do you see that as the college's role, actually?
Well, I was just going to say, I think employer leadership is key on this. And we know, a few well-placed articles in the New York Times, and suddenly Silicon Valley is very interested in diversity.
Right.
I think that's a pull strategy that helps, that suddenly there's now resources and messaging from those employers saying, we care about having a racially and gender diverse workforce, and we're going to work with our education partners to be sure we get that delivered to us. So I think there is something about employer leadership on some of this. I would be remiss if I didn't say that, in fact, in aggregate, leaving aside the non-traditional occupations, in aggregate, we have our problem in higher education is actually getting men into
right.
colleges.
60-40 now.
And getting success for men in colleges and community college. So that
if you have a system, an unorganized system, where people kind of come into college without much, sort of social support behind them and stumble around into a bunch of courses that we want to expose them to, there's no lever that we have to deal with that. If we have a more strategic approach to helping students figure out what they want to do and helping them do more coherent exploration of their opportunities, then at least there's a lever that we can, that we can pull to try to deal with that. Other than that, we don't have any, other than a billboard or something like that, which, I think is a great idea, but I don't think we can count on that to really do that.
I think this woman.
Monica Herc, Committee for Economic Development. So this is another measurement data question. The state's got money for longitudinal P20 data systems, which we're supposed to be the P being pre-K up through 20s. So at least theoretically, if a student was in community college and then stayed in the same state to work, then states should be able to track that through, like, the UI data and so on. So do we not have that not even in one or two or three states, so we can start learning about the connections between certificates, training, and employment outcomes, at least initially.
Virginia is doing quite a lot of that, isn't it? Texas has been doing quite a bit.
I guess my, well, you probably have some experience with that.
So I'm actually a part of Tom's CAPC group. So I've been working with the Ohio data for a long time. And so it is linked, some of it, between the institutional P20 data, or we actually just have higher ed is linked to UI. So
unemployment insurance, just in case.
Right. So we really need, you know, that to be linked back to K-12. But also there are sort of constant issues related to just kind of the politics of who has access to data. I thought the first panel was really interesting in that it sort of made it sound like we're collecting all of this data, and really the problem is that there aren't enough researchers, and we don't have the research capacity to analyze it. But if that's true, there's clearly some sort of relationship breakdown in the pipeline, you know, because there are lots of people that want to answer these questions, including myself, with state data sets, with national data sets, and definitely with data that has to be linked to the UI data. The state data has to be linked to the UI data.
I think there's also, I'm not an expert on this, but I think at the sub-associate's degree level, some of those certificates, there's not a common coding process for that. It's very, very messy to really try and figure out. And if you might have an institution that has its own sort of named and designed certificate that, you know, it would be different at another institution. So I think actually being able to drill down on that is still a challenge, right?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, but there, I mean, you can see something. You know, for example, in the Ohio data, I can observe that somebody earned a certificate. I can observe what kind of certificate they earned, and I can observe what they declared as their major.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. That's not all the detail that we would really want to evaluate these workforce certificate programs. But, you know, I
there's
get part way there.
So, I mean, I'm not sure I've seen the effect of the K-20 state longitudinal data systems. I mean, we have worked in 5 or 6 or 7 states to try to collect, try to take K-12 to community college, four-year college, and link that to UI data. It's extremely difficult. I mean, we have kind of an infrastructure to do it, and it's still very difficult to do that. State policies, the interpretations of FERPA change, so we may have a relationship with one state now, and that in next year that we won't have access to those data. So I think that it's a very difficult process, and certainly if we want to be able to easily and have a much broader, I mean, Adele's working with the professor Bridget Terry Long, who worked with those Ohio's data for 10 years. So that's the kind of relationship that you need to have to get access to those data. If you as a researcher go into some state capital, it's going to be years before you get a nice data set that you can work with. So I mean, I think that's as far as really being able to understand what that is. I mean, we do have the National Clearinghouse data, which allows us to track individual students among, you know, throughout the whole education system. It doesn't have a lot of detail in it, but
doesn't go back to K-12.
That's right. So, well, and starting to, but that's the, so we're in kind of a wild west of data. And I think there's some political currents that are actually making it more difficult for us to get those data now.
More questions?
Hi, I'm also someone with a second question. My question is about funding and accreditation for a lot of these manufacturing training programs that are at the community colleges. They are oftentimes non-credit bearing, or they're moving up towards an AAS degree, which doesn't transfer easily to a four-year degree. The funding side, if the programs are non-accredited, then you can't access federal financial aid or Pell Grants for these. So can you talk about maybe how the Higher Education Act, which is coming up, could affect this, or just policies that you've seen that can help ease this burden?
I also want to build on that question, because I've been sort of interested in what changes about the programs depending on who's paying for it. If it's a student fund, is a student paying out of their pocket? Is it coming out of a federal grant if it's accredited? If the employer pays for it, if, you know, the we saw some stuff in the Washington Post recently about the roles of unions in doing this kind of training when unions are paying for it.
Yep.
I mean, can we talk? So can we answer her question, but also sort of extend that a little bit and talk a little bit about the nature of how these programs might change depending on who's financing them?
I guess it's difficult to answer that question because in many cases it depends on the state. All the states are different with respect to how they regulate or certify, you know, different programs. I mean, you'll have, you know, some states fund non-credit, for example, and other states don't. So you'll find that in the states that fund non-credit, there's a lot more non-credit. And in the states that don't, lots of that non-credit is now incorporated into a degree program because you can have access to financial aid. I do think that that there's a trend towards trying to more to be more concrete about the requirement that students be in programs for them to be able to access financial aid. I think that's a good thing. We can make a program. I mean, you can be in a program which is not very well organized, called general studies, or and that's, yes, you're in a program, but that doesn't really lead anywhere, isn't well organized, and doesn't, you know, it's not very effective. So I think that's one. That's one area. I mean, employers or colleges will do non-credit programs because they're easy to mount. They can do those quickly. They don't have to go to the state capitol to get them accredited or anything. An employer comes in and says, you know, they want some training, or else there's layoffs and there's trainings. Those are the kind, you know, the colleges can do those quickly, and in many cases they do those very effectively. And if they're going to go through a process that will make them part of a program, then those students will be eligible for financial aid, you know, then that slows that down. So
I would just say two things on this. One is a sort of broad comment, which is, you know, if you just look at federal resources and how they're allocated around adult education and training, our Higher Education Act is our de facto workforce development program. We have the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity funding, but if you look at the amounts of money relative to the Title IV higher education, it's minuscule, small amounts of money. And so I think you're asking exactly the right question, which is, given that that is in fact the case, we may not acknowledge it, but it is in fact the case, then how do you open that up, or how do you make sure that it's able to get to that objective? The second thing I would say is that I think there are, been baby steps taken to try and put a little bit more flexibility in terms of how Pell and other Higher Education Act resources can be accessed. Ability to benefit, some of the waiver authority that around program length that individual institutions have. I think there are things that start to open that up, and I think doing that carefully and considered with good research is a good move for this next iteration of the Higher Education Act.
Well, and then there was just this announcement last week that the department is going to have a discussion about opening up Title IV to more non-traditional providers, and
yep.
That was always put in the context of like coding academies and all this groovy stuff out of Silicon Valley. But when I wonder whether it could also be some of these other kinds of training programs that are a little bit more manufacturing based, or mm-hmm. That those people weren't. I don't know that those people are invited to the meeting yet, but.
Well, and then there's the discussion of certifications or competency-based education-based types of certifications, which. And whether those will be accredited and to what extent students can access those financial aid when they're enrolled in those programs. So that's a huge issue of that there's a lot of discussion about that. I think we have a long way to go before that all gets sorted out. But I think I assume that as we discuss the reauthorization, that those types of things will be extensively discussed.
I think there's more questions out there, but can one of you hit on my union question at least a little bit?
Oh.
I mean, we've talked a lot about employer training,
yep.
Employer college training.
Yep.
I mean, is there a renewed role for union and college training programs?
I mean, certainly, I think there's huge promise there, particularly as you
get... Even with shrinking unions?
Even with among shrinking unions. One thing that unions do that an individual employer doesn't is they tend to work across firms. And so you end up with consortia, which I think gives programs that study much more impact and meaning because they're working across multiple firms. Given with the limitations of where unions are these days, I think there are some definite possibilities there. And I know, particularly in healthcare, there's quite a bit of work, really innovative work going on. In fact, I think today there's a meeting just across one of the rivers in town here around how to design apprenticeship and other kinds of incumbent worker training in healthcare.
Back there, thank you.
Hi, I'm Gretchen Peacock from Lockheed Martin, and there was a lot of discussion in the last panel about publicly held versus privately held companies and their flexibility in short-term versus long-term decision-making and what their goals are. And there's been a lot of discussion in this panel about the onus being on employers to take the lead in a lot of these activities. And so I was wondering if you had either any suggestions, recommendations, or success stories in publicly held companies working with community colleges and how that's played out.
So we certainly have plenty of examples of publicly held companies that are publicly traded companies that are doing great partnership work with community colleges.
Is there something that the community colleges side can do to make that work better?
Well, maybe? So I think number one is to be able to tell a story about outcomes and results. I think from the privately held companies, you don't hear a lot of talk about return on investment. My sense is that being able to have that backing in larger companies where you have to go to the CFO's office and say why this is an important investment of company resources. So I think it behooves us to have a little bit more. And who's from the Manufacturing Institute? That's the ROI calculator. So that's a great development. That's really good. And we should have more of that, I think, in order to get the publicly traded companies.
I think maybe you're from Michigan, so you might know more about this. I mean, historically, the community colleges have had a great relationship with the auto manufacturers. So now I think that is complicated a little bit now because I know in many of the programs that they had before, which were associate degree programs, are now bachelor's degree programs. So that some of the relationships that the colleges have had or have either revolved or have gone away. So if Chrysler has some kind of training program at the community colleges, I'm not sure how they're calculating that ROI, but they're certainly extensive. So I guess I would say that there's certainly many examples, as John said, of cases where colleges have worked together.
If I can say one other thing, which is I think there is increasing conversation about treating talent pipelines more like supply chains. And that's a conversation the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has been leading, but I've been hearing it independently from company recruiters and talent specialists, which means that they tend to be concentrating on institutions that seem to be able to deliver folks with the right skills and the right quantities. That they are really trying to set expectations, do better expectation setting through their so-called supply chain with educators. And I think all that then speaks to this need to be very focused on outcomes and being able to sort of deliver to specification, if you will.
And if the colleges can get themselves past gagging on that phrase, supply chain, and about thinking about their students.
Yeah, right.
Fair enough.
That's a cultural problem, actually.
Yeah. I thought it was great that in the previous panel about talking about the role of employers in providing training, because I think that we've gotten to the point where there's less employer training. I think historically we've seen that employer training is a direct relationship between the amount of education that the person has and the amount of employer training that they get. So if you have a master's degree, you'll get tons of employer training. But if you have an associate degree, you get much less. So I do think it's in, I was reading something in The Guardian the other day, and they said there's a skills gap and employers couldn't find anyone. So they did something unusual. They got somebody from McDonald's and they trained them, and that person now is doing a great job. And I said, well, so we've gotten to the point where it's an unusual strategy that employers are going to provide training to workers. So I do think that's a, I think we need to think about that when we hear about the skills gap stuff. And so I really applaud the previous panel for you know, emphasizing the importance of that, because I think that's something we've lacked here, or we haven't put enough emphasis on that. And another reason why I think it's difficult to really get the broad apprenticeship program.
Okay, well.
And I'd like to applaud.
Well, yeah, with that, what's old is new again, and we'll have to wrap it.
I'd like to applaud this panel for the Tony did a great job moderating the discussion, putting a lot of ideas out on the table. Bella drew on her personal experience as an adjunct instructor at a community college, and now her current experience being a researcher trying to figure out some of these relationships. John had one of the lines of the panel talking about how the credentialing system is broken in the way we do some fundamental work. And then Tom, of course, is the guy who is so knowledgeable about all aspects of community colleges. So we look forward to a continuing both of these kinds of issues, the workforce development and community college issues, as well as the broader manufacturing. So thank you very much. We really appreciate your interest.